Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
Atomic bomb is terrible, but more terrible still are the effects of atomic mutation. Hello, I'm Lawrence Woolsey, and I want to warn you about something that could happen, something that does happen in my newest motion picture. Observe the ant, a miniature marvel of social cooperation and prodigious strength. But if a man and an ant were exposed to radiation simultaneously, the result would be terrible indeed, for the result would be Mant. I feel I should warn you, the story of Mant is based on scientific fact, on theories that have appeared in national magazines. Yes, these terrible events could happen in your town, in your home, and they will happen in this theater, in Atomovision. The new motion picture miracle that puts you in the action.
It is 19 minutes after the hour of one, and this the month of August in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. Thank you for joining us. We are here high above the milk packing district in the heart of beautiful Southeast Portland, Oregon. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor. This is the Rick Emerson radio program, cavalcade of whimsy, the likes of which you have never known. You know, the very best thing about that little sounder there from Matinee, starring John Goodman, and some chick who I can never quite, and not Kathy Moriarty, it's the young girl who is telling everybody that the duck and cover drill is a bunch of BS. Where she says, they're telling you to hide underneath your desk to protect yourself from radiation, only you can't protect yourself from radiation, because it's a whole, like, Cold War sort of Cuban Missile Crisis kind of a thing. Anyway, I can never figure out who that girl is, but it seems like I've spotted her in other things. It seems like I've seen her maybe before that or after that. At some point, I saw her in other movies, and I can never quite place her, and then I always forget to look it up. Doesn't really matter. What matters is this. It's the moment where Goodman has, like, the long, pregnant pause, and then he just says, because he says, for the result would be Mant. And it's the way that he sort of slowly, he kind of arches one eyebrow up ever so slightly, and then he says it, and then he puts a cigar back in his mouth. And it's those three things. There's four things. The pause, the speak, the arch, the cigar. It all works flawlessly. Also, it is, I don't know who wrote the movie Matinee, which is really a fine film. And if you haven't seen it, I encourage you to do so. If you haven't seen the movie Matinee with John Goodman, you are missing out. And I know that it's not like people single out a lot of John Goodman films. There's things that, hey, you gotta see King Ralph. That really is a piece of celluloid like you have never... It ain't no King Ralph. Matinee's a fantastic movie. And I don't know who the screenwriter was, but I will bet you my bottom dollar that when that screenwriter came up with he's half man, he's half ant, he's Mant, I bet that's where the entire thing crystallized in his head. I bet that was the impetus for it right there. I bet he went out and he bought himself a ceremonial case of whatever it is he drinks once he came up with Mant. It's astounding that there actually wasn't a motion picture called Mant at some point in the 50s or 60s. I mean, it seems like he's one of those things, one of those Tai Chi Chai Tea things. It's so obvious in retrospect. I mean, it's sort of astounding that nobody came up with it first. All right, well, in any event, doesn't really matter. And hello, it is the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. 6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. You know, I'm turning on the phones over here, and there's two different settings, and I don't really understand the difference. Don, do you use Skype?
No.
All right. Well, you're the wrong person to ask. Never mind.
Damn right.
It's a fool to bring you my questions.
Because, remember,
you know,
that.
Skype is basically an instant messenger that also has, like, a phone function, which, to be fair, I think the other ones do, too. I think you can call people on your phone or whatever with Yahoo or with Gmail or something. But, you know, but Skype is they sort of carved out that territory first. But, you know, on an instant messenger, there's, like, there's a status setting where you can put, like, I am away, I'm available, I'm busy, currently pleasuring myself. You know, whatever it is. You know,
is that an actual setting that comes with the
Skype
program?
But there's a custom setting, which I assume is for that.
Oh.
Sort of a, I'm sorry, I seem to have stained my keyboard. I will be back in a moment. Or whatever. But on Skype, there's the invisible, offline, do not disturb, not available, away, online. And then there's Skype me, which is a status setting there and in the pull-down menu. And I don't know the difference between online and Skype. Maybe online just means, like, I'm here if you need to talk to me. And maybe Skype me is sort of like a let's chat, girlfriend, sort of a thing. It was you're exhorting people to get in touch with you. Dawn Taylor in the back.
Not a clue. No idea.
Thanks for helping.
I avoid those sorts. I avoid anything that will have people talking to me in real time on my computer while I'm working on my computer.
So you eschew the whole instant messenger thing? See, that surprises me. I thought you'd be all about instant messaging.
No.
Because then people can talk to you, but you can ignore it or turn it off and then go, I was having network issues.
The thing is, when I'm on the computer, I'm doing generally one of two things. I am either working or I'm like watching a movie or watching some kind of programming. And in either case, I don't want people like popping up and chatting with me. Because the thing is, it goes bing, and then they say something to you, and then you feel obligated to say something. And if I don't respond right away, I know it's there. And then it annoys me.
Did you get the...
Yeah.
As you're talking about, you know, when I'm trying to do something, then there's a thing that pops up and goes bing.
And then
the phone rang. And then I think I just inadvertently hung up on whoever that was. Oh, I'm sorry. Wait, let's see if I... Ah, damn it. That's just me. And I went to answer it, and I actually just... I turned everything off, and I went to answer the phone. I think... Yeah.
Want people to think I don't like them. Like, if I don't talk to them, like, they'll think I don't like them or something. So I just... It's like I'm on Google Mail, and it has a thing that... This little green ball appears to let people know that you're there. So I just always have it set on, like, I'm busy.
Mine is always on mine's always on invisible. Where just, in other words, it doesn't look like I'm online. In none of my, you know, like my Gmail or my Yahoo or whatever, it always is set to off. It doesn't matter whether I'm online or not. It never says that I am. And that's the thing I learned from Sarah, because Sarah for a while didn't know that you could turn the green ball thing off. But she was constantly getting a little sound from people that were like wanting to, hey, I like your hair. Will you do me? Or whatever. And then she was just like, how do I turn this thing? But then she said that she just kept it in invisible all the time. Okay, so the guy who tried to call me, who I inadvertently hung up on, sorry about that, Michael, he says, Skype me means you are listed publicly in their directory. Oh, that's interesting. So there's an online, like, Skype sort of phone book. Wow. Boy, howdy. What they do have nowadays. All right, so there you go. Well,
just crazy technology.
I'm going to set it to Skype me, and we'll just see what happens. All right. All right, there you go.
You're hoping we'll just get random phone calls from strangers during the show now?
Here's the thing. We get random stranger phone calls now.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, thank you. Thank you to the person, the guy who just texted, hey, Rick, I like your hair. Will you do me? Well, maybe. I mean, it takes more than a compliment, sir. It takes at least a single flower. Or perhaps write me a pretty melody. Anyway, if you want to email, you can do that as well. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. You can email Dawn as well. It's dawn@rickemerson.com. D-A-W-N at rickemerson.com. Coming up today, Hick Watch, Obama Watch, Job Watch coming up today. Pop Culture Authority. Today we answer the question, what's up with the phrase, balls to the wall? I have the answer right here. So you'll be hearing that in Rumble-Rama today, right here in the Rick Emerson radio program. Balls to the Wall will give the explanation for that. Also, Brett Burmeister, he is a Portland blogger specializing in the discussion of food carts. And I have once again forgotten to bring any sort of food for myself. So he's going to start talking about, I don't know, some like bacon thing that's filled, you know, with a variety of sauces. You know, and then I'm just going to start salivating openly on the air. So we can all prepare for that right now. and whatnot. Don Taylor's tracking the following stories for you on this Friday.
Streets in Northeast Portland have been evacuated because of an explosive device. An alarming number of Americans believe the president is Muslim. And a Canby princess's horse drops dead during the rodeo.
Is there really such a thing as a Canby princess?
Well, she's a Canby rodeo princess, and I didn't want to use the word rodeo twice in the same sentence.
Ah, there you go. That's the, you know what it is? That's skill and craft in one's writing art, Don. That's exactly what that is.
Why, thank you.
Anyway, so that's all on the way today. So we got Brett Burmeister talking about Portland food carts, Hick Watch, Obama Watch, Job Watch, and we'll get to another installment. Pop, what are you eating over there?
Raw hot dog.
Okay, first of all, it's not a raw hot dog. It's just uncooked, because a raw hot dog would mean you're just jamming pork or beef or whatever it's made out of into your mouth.
Uncooked hot dog.
Is that thing where you're eating? How can you eat a cold hot dog? Was it cooked and then, like, last night for dinner, but then, it's a leftover? Or is it, like, out of the package? Oh, no. Don't show it to me.
Straight
out
of the package there.
No, I don't want to look at it. No. Do not want.
It's like bologna in a tube. You eat bologna on sandwiches,
well,
don't you?
I don't, first of all. But that's a separate issue. Am I the only one who feels silly using the phrase bologna? Or the word bologna? It just sounds...
Well, I would prefer to say, like, bologna.
Now, is that how you actually pronounce it?
Yeah.
Because it's after the city.
Bologna.
Is it after, is it a place in Italy?
Technically, it should be Bologna.
Is it a country or a...
It's a city.
A city in Italy?
In Italy.
All right.
But no one says Bologna.
But even if they did, I don't think I could feel... It's just a funny sounding word. I think it's too close to, like, balloon or something. And plus, it's got, a bunch of slang terms, whatever, to mean nonsense or so forth. So no, I do not eat that particular... And I'm not opposed to meat. Rick Emerson loves meat. He's a big meat fan. But I don't... That's the one thing I can't get with. Like, I can get with any sort of, like, a pastrami or a ham or a turkey or whatever. There's something... First of all, I don't even know what bologna is. I mean, what's in that?
Basically, it falls, again, into the sausage category. Overall, the forced meat
but there's
sausage
a, But catalog. There's, like, a beef sausage and turkey sausage and whatever.
Right.
That's more about the
well,
shape of the
thing. Well,
there's
beef bologna and chicken bologna and turkey bologna
all
as
right.
well.
All right, but okay, but here's the...
And bologna, again, it's the shape of it. It comes... It's basically a great big round or great big tubular sausage, and then it's sliced.
So
what you're getting is sliced sausage, bologna sausage.
Wait a minute. So you're saying that something... Whether or not something is bologna is determined by its shape.
Its shape and the ingredients. I mean, that's basically the distinction between all sausages.
See, that's my thing, though. So, if I was like, what do you got here? Well, I got a pork sausage. Well, you know what it is. It's a small cylinder of meat made out of whatever. Mm-hmm. But if I were to say, well, what are the ingredients in bologna, generally speaking?
Ground meat and spices, much the same as with any sausage.
But is it when you say ground meat, but you know what I'm asking. Are these leavings?
Yes.
Am I getting snouts and asses?
Often, yes.
Okay.
Same as with hot dogs.
That's what I'm saying. If you say like a steak, you know what a steak is.
Mm-hmm.
They're not cutting up. They're not giving you cow nostrils that have been ground up and formed into some sort of beef, shape, some sort of object. But if you order bologna, I always just assume they're sweeping up at the rendering plant and then it all just goes into a mulcher.
I just always assume that too, and that's one of the reasons like the cheaper hot dogs tend to taste better, I think, because the crappier the meat they put in it, the more like delicious spices they add to cover up the gaminess of the meat.
Which is why
I don't really like the really good ones, like, your Farmer John hot dogs and your ballpark hot dogs.
I like
the Bar S hot dogs, the ones that are like 99 cents a package. And they just have like a ton of like paprika and stuff in it to cover up the fact that it's like hooves and lips.
I don't go for your upscale Jimmy Dean type foods like some of you city folk. I don't get you, man. You're the weirdest person. I mean that. And I mean that in a good way. I don't mean that as a knock. Because life is only interesting because of interesting people. So you're one of the... first of all, didn't you this morning, didn't I come in? Were you talking about you were eating some custard or some crumble or a cobbler or something this morning?
No, I was offered cobbler. Ben, one of the handsome young electrician guys from downstairs, came by and he came to the door and he was like, hey, hi. And I said, hi. And then he said, do you want some blackberry cobbler? And I was like, ugh. And it's one of those things that
Ben, by the way, we should give a little backstory in case you haven't heard this before. So Ben, Ben is a guy, so we share a building with a couple other folk, a few other businesses, and the business downstairs is they do electrical work and installation and maintenance, whatever. And there's some fine strapping lads who work in the warehouse.
There are indeed.
And Ben is a good-looking man. He's an attractive man, obviously in shape. Also, he's got the kind of in shape. I didn't mean to sound all, all like I want to go give him a tongue bath or anything. I'm just saying, there's no getting around it. He's the kind of in shape, too, that I don't think it sounds... It's not like he goes to the gym.
Just youthful and lifts heavy things all day.
I was going to say, that is the kind of naturally muscular physique that comes with being a working man.
Yeah.
Unlike myself, where I'm just, I'm basically Mr. Class. So he's an attractive man with a Battlestar Galactica tattoo. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, he offered you cobbler this morning. I wasn't here for this. What kind of cobbler was it?
He said it was blackberry cobbler. I think he was warming it up in the microwave, too, so it would have been warm blackberry cobbler. And I was just kind of like, gah, because as I mentioned earlier, I hit one of my primary weight loss goals, one of my first big weight loss goals this morning. And so it's kind of like, so here comes this handsome young man in here, like luring me with cobbler.
It was almost.
And I was just like, no!
Do you feel like Job, where God was creating that just to tempt you?
Yeah.
You know, you find hot guy, Battlestar Galactica tattoo, cobbler straight from the microwave, yeah. Still warm.
Literally, it's like Isaiah Mustafa in the Old Spice ads. Like, he's just sort of like, ladies, I'm handsome. Have some cobbler.
Let me ask you this. Was the cobbler, was it like from the store? Do you think he might have made it himself?
I didn't look. I didn't ask. I did nothing because I really knew that. And first, I had just had like a
toasted bagel. Is this a thing where you won't eat in front of guys?
No, that's not really it at all.
Because some chicks won't eat in front of guys.
No, what it is that I'm really actually actively trying to drop some weight.
And successfully, so I might add.
And I just don't want to get back on that train because sugar is my big downfall. Sugar, I actually am avoiding eating refined sugar as much as I possibly can right now because I'm just a complete carbohydrate fiend. And if I start eating pasta and potatoes and my big indulgence is having like one bagel a day. But it's like, if I start eating sugar, I'm just doomed. The next thing, I'm just like mainlining, breakfast cereal and eating Cap'n Crunch right out of the box or something. Because it's my major downfall.
I'm sorry, I'm not laughing at you. I sort of am, but and you'll have to forgive me, please. I apologize in advance for this. So please, honestly, you have to just draw no, please draw no inference from this. You just did this hand. I wish everybody could. You just did this hand gesture when you were talking about eating Captain Crunch right out of the box, and it was the universally understood gesture for tilting back one's head, lifting the bag or the box up, and tapping the end of it, and then shaking it to get the last of the whatever into your mouth.
The delicious Captain Crunch dust out of the bottom of the bag. Yes.
Which I will do with. See, here's the thing. I was going to say secret indulgence, but now that I'm revealing it, here's the thing that I, and we've talked about this. Every now and again, I will get a little bit of a sugar craving, and then I'm powerless against it most of the time. And fortunately, because the people who are really screwed are the people who have they're powerless against sugar craving, and then they get the craving constantly. Fortunately, I have no willpower at all of any kind. Let's have no illusions about that. I'm a weak man. I'm the weakest man you've ever met. But fortunately, I don't have a lot of things like that I have to sort of fight against. So that's the good news. Because like last night, for example, I'm sitting there and I'm getting some work done, and I forget what I was doing. I was updating the webpage or something, and I had that whole like, I could go for something sugary right now. I wonder what we have in the house. And of course, in the house there was nothing. What there is, though, is a planned pantry. There's a planned pantry like two blocks from my office, where I'm sitting in my spongy chair with my wearing a big ass groove, and I thought, Lars asleep, the dogs are asleep. The whole house is quiet. There's no one to see my shame, and it's that thing where you're going, well, I don't know. It's like 1 a.m. I guess I could just go to, and then the next thing you know, I'm halfway down the street to the plaid pantry buying a box of Crunch and Munch.
Uh-huh.
And it's that horrible box of Crunch and Munch. It's not the big ass family kind, but it's not the little single Cracker Jack kind. It's in between the two somehow. So it's not enough to feed, like, two people who are, like, both wanting to really snack, but it's way more than one person ought to eat. Here's the other thing about it,
yeah.
And I know you know this pain. It's that when you have something that is like that, where it's an in-between size box of Cruncher Munch, let's say, you almost have to eat the whole thing, because if you don't, you're going to have enough left over that it's just going to taunt you later.
Yeah.
Like, it'll just be enough for like half a handful. So then, if you don't want to just be pissed off later on, because I could go for some Cruncher Munch, oh, there's only five, you know, kernels or whatever in here. So then the only other thing then is to throw it away, to not have it around. And
you're not going to do that.
I am physically incapable of throwing food away. I cannot. And people know this. I know people that they will not throw food away if I am there, because I will yell at them about it. I'm not talking about
throw food away if it's gone bad.
I can't
do it if it's delicious
that's
food.
That's my thing. If it's gotten moldy or gamey or it's gone, you know, like spoiled milk or what food with, you know, that's gone all hairy or whatever, I'll throw that away. But I'm talking about something where, because you, Sarah's like this. Sarah. She would make, she'll make pasta or something for lunch at the beginning of the show, let's say. So let's say she makes herself a little pasta dish at like 10 or 11 in the morning. And then she'll eat it, you know, she won't eat all of it, and she'll set it on the counter in the kitchen. And then at the end of the show, at like 2, you know, in the afternoon, she'll throw it out because it's been sitting out for a couple hours and she feels it's gone bad. And she and I have just agreed not to discuss it because it makes me furious. And that is a holdover from... And I didn't grow up destitute. I wanted to make it like I grew up in like a shotgun shack or something. My parents did not have a lot of money. Oftentimes where they were unemployed, and so it was really drilled into us that you eat it, you keep it as long as you possibly can, you don't throw it away, you don't waste it, and so that has stuck with me as an adult. Anyway, so I can't throw the Cruncher Munch out, but there's enough there that, you know, that it's just going to make me annoyed next time. So then I eat the entire thing. And what am I doing then? I'm holding up the box of Cruncher Munch in the little silvery, golden, delicious foil bag inside and just dumping the dust into my mouth. And so when you just did that thing now where you're talking about eating the Captain Crunch, you know what I picture you and me both as? Is Sherman Klump when he's just sitting in the chair, and it's the greatest moment in any of those Nutty Professor movies. It's the gold moment where he has the huge canister of M&Ms, and he tilts his head back, and he's just pouring them into his mouth, and he's crying, which is the best thing Eddie Murphy has ever done. That scene right there, that scene and all of Delirious, that is the sum total of his genius right there. God damn. Anyway, so that's what I ate last night. And that was after rooting around in the cupboard, and I swear to God, eating a stale single Dorito that I found on a shelf in the back of one of the cupboards. I don't even know how long it had been there. I was looking for some stuff last night, like, oh, maybe I have some Triscuits. Here's the other thing, is my final shame chapter. I really do have an unhealthy relationship with food. Let's have no illusions about that. Just because I'm a skinny guy, that mean that I don't, and I hate to be one of those skinny people who's like, and then I just eat everything all day long. And I know that I'm lucky in having the metabolism I do. I know this. This is not a thing that I'm saying to annoy people. I just say, I know that I am lucky because I am so completely crazy when it comes to food. I mean, I am not, I don't know that I have any sort of food addiction, but I know that I act as though I do. So who knows?
Well, I've watched you eat, and like people who have food issues, I learned this when I was in therapy for food issues, that people have rituals.
Yeah.
People who have food issues have food rituals.
Addictions have rituals.
And I've watched you eat, and it's really interesting to watch you, how you will like sit there and like, for example, you'll get a sandwich or whatever, and you'll just ignore it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, it reminds me of like when the cat's playing with a ball and the cat decides, oh, I don't want the ball to know that I'm interested
in
it. So I'll just look the other way. And you'll ignore it for a while. And then at some point, it's like something flicks on in your brain and you're like, it is time to eat the food now. And it's like, and then suddenly, yeah, you are just... Now you are completely focused 100% on nothing but eating the sandwich.
And I'm a fast eater, too. That's the other thing. That's the thing that my wife has tried to beat out of me. She has tried to get me to eat more slowly because, well, if we ever have dinner with somebody else or we have, like, another couple or we're out with friends or at a restaurant or something, where you put the food in front of me, and I don't know where... I guess it's all, like, childhood stuff because, you know, my mom was an incredibly fast eater because she was a nurse. And her whole thing was, you might not get a chance to eat for another 10 hours. So she's like, if you got 5 minutes to eat, like, you shove it in. And also, they're like six kids and whatever.
Yeah.
So you put the food in front of me, and I'll wait. And then, like Zoidberg, I just sort of go, And then it's gone. The other thing is that I have the ritual where I eat, if they're available at the same time, if they're all served at once, I start with the dessert. I eat the dessert first. Then I eat the side dish, like the tater tots. Then I eat the main course last. And that probably indicates something as well. So
see, my thing is crazy. When I was doing the thing, when I was learning there were food rituals, I didn't think I had any because I was watching these, you know, bulimics and stuff who had weird, truly weird little things they would do. And I didn't think I had anything. And then finally it came out, somebody, one of the counselors pointed it out to me, actually. I eat all of my food so that I even it out. Because I don't like to eat any one thing at a time. I like to, like, you know, rotate
it through. Portion-wise?
Well, yeah. And I will start it, because you always have different sizes. Like, the sandwich is so big.
Right.
And then you've got, like, your chips or whatever, and there's a little bit of that, and there's a couple of pieces of fruit. And I will start eating everything, and without consciously realizing it, I will eat it down so I have exactly the same amount of everything.
Right, yeah.
And then I will just keep rotating through it until I have, like one or two bites left of each thing.
So you can finish all at the same time.
But also so then I can finish with a bite in like the one bite each of the opposite of how much I like it. So like
building up to the dessert.
Building
basically.
Up to whatever the thing was I liked best on the plate.
Yeah, you're weird.
Yeah.
You're crazy.
But I do it completely without realizing consciously I'm doing it. And I told my husband about it once, and now he points it out. We'll be sitting here doing something and eating in a restaurant and talking, and he'll go, ha, look. And he'll point, and there's like one bite each of everything
on
my
plate. You're doing the crazy thing again.
Yeah.
If you spend a lot of your life single or whatever, you don't notice any of those things until somebody points them out. They go, hey, you're doing this weird thing. And then you realize that you do it all the time. So, all right. Well, you passed up cobbler. Well, I'm impressed. Well done for you, Don
Taylor.
Well,
thank you very much. It helped that I had just eaten a bagel and was actually, eaten food. Because if I actually had been hungry and the cute boy came in and he said, do you want blackberry cobbler?
Let me ask you.
And I'm like a fat girl who loves food. And I will admit this to all the radio listeners. It is the first day of, my period. So all of these things is a confluence. If I'd actually been hungry and he'd done this, I probably just would have leapt out of the chair and tackled him.
Just licked the side of his face.
And just licked all the cobbler off of his body in the hallway out there.
Awkward.
And then we would have been in trouble with the landlord.
Yeah. Or not. I mean, depending. He might have just, he might have just stood in line. Who knows? I got some cobbler of my own. Or if not, I got a cheese log. Let's see. I'm going to have to find out if he made the cobbler. Here's the thing, because I like cobbler. Because, because it's got this sort of bready thing going on.
Yeah, you got the whole crunchy, textury, sweet thing on the top of the fruit.
God damn it, you damn woman. Now we've done the thing. Now I'm hungry. Oh, fail.
You were supposed to get us something to snack on.
Wave that raw hot dog at me.
Yeah, eat my raw hot dog.
You're disgusting. All right. Well, in any event, there you go. So there was that. That happened. Okay, I'm not going to think about it. Let's see. So coming up later on today, Portland blogger specializing in food carts. Mr. Brett Burmeister is going to be with us. We also got the Hick Watch, Obama Watch, Job Watch. And today's pop culture authority will answer the question, what does that phrase balls to the wall mean? Where does it come from? Don't forget, today's program brought to you by fine folks, including Michael Beatty at The Cleaning Solution, 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211. Last but certainly not least, later on today, we're going to be introducing a brand new feature in The Rick Emerson Show, Stupid Criminal of the Week. So that's on the way. So we'll get to all that. I think I've done all the bits of business, so we'll just say without further ado, ladies and gentlemen.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
A section of streets were closed off in northeast Portland, and a bomb squad dispatched after police spotted what they described as an explosive device. Area businesses were also evacuated as a precaution. Police were serving a search warrant at an apartment complex near the intersection of Northeast 99th Avenue and Gleason when they spotted the device inside a parked car. Investigators said they also saw bomb-making equipment. Police have blocked off Northeast Gleason Street from 97th to 102nd Avenues and a block in each direction, north and south, as the bomb squad arrived. TriMet officials says the closure is impacting two bus routes, number 19 and number 27. The incident began around 10 a.m. this morning. Police said a man has been arrested on an outstanding warrant, but they were not yet ready to release his name. Yesterday, a man set off a small explosive device in southeast Portland near the intersection of 102nd and Pine. Police said the device exploded in a flower bed outside an insurance company office. No one was hurt, and police arrested the suspect as he tried to flee on a bicycle. And last night, a bomb threat led to the closure of a major road in Alloa. No device was found in that incident, but Southwest Tualatin Valley Highway was blocked from 185th to 198th Avenues for nearly 2 hours during the investigation.
And by the way, I should say that we've got this from the text box. A couple things. One, Dawn is making stuff up again. Bologna is not snouts and asses. I watched how they make it on the Science Channel. It's normal meat like other meat. It's just really expensive versions that rich people pay for. Wait, or it is or is not? Just not really expensive versions that rich people... Okay, so it's just like a regular cut. And then this. This just says, you know, I put hot dogs one step above the McRib, just so you know. Yeah, can I just tell you this? I feel like I'm a bad American because I've never had the McRib. And it's been in existence for a long time, and I have yet to have it.
I never have either.
Can I just tell you, sometimes I make it sound like I have a trashier family than everybody. And my family is pretty trashy in their own sort of lovable way. But I'm not alone in that. And here's the proof. So my father-in-law, Lara's dad, they're a, they're a fat and starch-loving people. You look in their cupboard, and most of the things they've got are just made with, just bleach flour and lard. So this is the family, and her dad's a great guy, really, and I mean that truly. But he's a man of simple culinary tastes. And they love fast food. They love starchy things. They love the smorgasbord restaurant, all of that stuff. I mean, that is like their fine eating. I think it's where they go for their anniversary and whatever, to Chuck-O-Rama. And sounds like I'm making it up, and I'm not. So, but her dad has this ritual where, because it's hard for him to get out of the house a lot because he's in a wheelchair and everything. But so the deal is whenever the McRib, which I guess is not like a normal menu staple, is the McRib is like an occasional thing apparently. It's like it's like those blackberry shakes or whatever at Burgerville. I guess the McRib is like a once a year kind of a thing.
I don't know.
The reason I know this though is whenever the McRib, as Jack Osborne would say, is back, her dad will make a trip to McDonald's. And he will purchase like 150 McRibs. And then he will take them all home and he will freeze them. And then over the course of like the rest of the year, he will thaw them, or as they say in Utah, unthaw them. And then he'll cook them wherever, I would hope in a toaster oven to eliminate the sog factor. And then he'll eat them. And so he buys like enough McRib to get him through like the next calendar year. It's either horrible or impressive. So, I mean, maybe it's a little bit of both, actually,
Yeah, that's an awful lot of work to go to when one could actually just get actual real pork ribs.
Well, but, that doesn't have the same, magical flavor to it, I don't know. I've never had McRib. Who am I to judge?
I never have either.
There is a certain something to McDonald's food, though. I'll give you that. I don't go to McDonald's much these days. I don't do a lot of fast food or drive through. That was the two big, because again, it's not like I'm a big fat guy, but, can I just tell you this? Who did I show my ID to when I went to the place up the street, the Los Gorditas or whatever the place is? They checked my ID. Can I tell you? Actually, I didn't get the thing where it's sometimes they'll card you and it's like because you're all impressed because your age, you don't look your age or whatever. The woman actually looked at my ID, gave it back to me, and then held it back up next to and looked at it next to my face because she noted that my ID didn't look anything like me at all. And I was like, well, what the hell is that about? And then I looked at Teddy and I realized it's because I was just a big spongy bastard.
You can look at the pictures of you from a few years ago, and you were noticeably heavier.
I get the fat face going on anyway. But the two concessions I made, the two things I did to try to not be not be so spongy. I quit drinking soda, which I was never a big soda drinker, but I would drink some of that, especially if it came with like a fast food. And I just cut out the for one solid year, I did not go to a fast food restaurant. And then what I learned is just me that after not doing it for a year, it became much easier to only do it every now and again. So now once in a great while, I go to McDonald's to get something, but I do it like once every 6 months or something. And I just quit it for a year, and that made it a lot easier to not do it anymore.
Yeah, about 6 months ago, my husband just made the decision he was having some blood pressure issues. And so he decided he was going to cut back on salt. He stopped eating any fast food. He stopped drinking soda. And he also, because he just realized he needed to do so, he stopped just snacking on candy.
Yeah.
And he wasn't really, I wouldn't say he was a heavy guy, but he was a little heavier than he'd like to be.
Without tone.
He had 6'2". And with just making those changes and really not doing anything else, he dropped 35 pounds.
Yeah.
It just went away.
The thing of not going to fast food and not drinking soda, it was actually kind of scary how quickly I lost some weight. And you realize then, well, that weight was just there because of those things. I mean, that's how easy it is to gain weight, I guess.
I saw a thing on the intranets that apparently there is some scientific theory, some nutritional theory, that even drinking diet sodas can actually impact your weight because of the way your body responds
thinks it's
to
sugar.
Yeah, to what it perceives as sweetness and sugar, and also the,
like a placebo.
And also what happens to like the sodium and the sugar and the carbonation and stuff.
But is it
in
like a placebo thing where your body thinks it's sugar so it acts like it's sugar?
I'm really not sure. It was really complicated and I didn't exactly understand it. But apparently even diet soda just causes your brain to just go, no, better pack on the weight, you know. So
interesting.
Yeah.
All right then. Well, let's do one more. We'll take a break. We'll do pop culture. Wait, are we doing that later? I'm sorry. That's we hadn't really decided. So I'll tell you what. Let's not get behind. We'll do pop culture authority later on today.
Well, we'll do the stupid criminal of the week thing. Yeah. Do you want to do that now, or do you want to do that after another story?
I'll tell you what. We'll do one more story. Then we'll do stupid criminal of the week. Then we'll break because Brett is supposed to be on here, and I don't want to get too terribly behind with that. We'll do pop culture authority sometime in the 2 o'clock hour. So stupid criminal of the week coming up. Up here in just a moment. This is Don Taylor.
Well, let's do our Obama watch.
All right, let me see if I can hope I made that part of the. All right, here's your Obama watch for Friday right here on the Rick Emerson program.
Like Barack Obama versus more of the same. If you're not into Clinton, if you're not for McCain, but if you want a new direction and you're tired of the games, vote with me for Obama and be an agent of change. And if you want to make it.
Here's your Obama watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Americans increasingly are convinced, incorrectly, that President Barack Obama is Muslim, and a growing number are thoroughly confused about his religion. Nearly one in five people, or 18%, said in a recent poll that they think Obama is Muslim, up from the 11% who said so in March 2009, according to a poll released Thursday. The proportion who correctly said he's Christian is down to just 34%.
Well, wait a minute. So how many? Now I'm confused. So 34% say he's Christian. What percent say he's Muslim?
18%.
So that's
think he's Muslim.
So that's 52%. Well, what does the other 48% think?
The largest share of people, 43%, said they don't know his religion, an increase from the 34% who said that in 2009.
Goddamn, people are dumb. Plus, by the way, that actually then 43, 50, so that actually means that there's like another 5% that answered something else, like they think it, like they think
he's
a
Jewish,
he's a Unitarian or he's a Scientologist or something. First of all, how could you not know he's Christian? And because. Here's the thing. He's president. They're all Christian. There's no getting to be president if you're not a Christian.
Yeah. To clear this up at all, well, is it? Do they clear this up in
You or me or for anyone else? Nothing can be cleared up for those, you know, for the 18%, I think.
Well, the president's spiritual advisor, Reverend Joel Hunter, says Mr. Obama is a Christian who has simply chosen to keep his religious life private.
When you don't define yourself, others will define you. And probably inaccurately and falsely, as is happening in this case.
Okay. Hunter says Mr. Obama is coming under fire because he treats other religions with respect.
It's remarkable to me that people think that because he tries to treat all faiths equally, that somehow that makes him less of a Christian.
Well, this is like his whole thing where – did you ever read the full statement that he made when he was asked the initial mosque question? They said – you know, he was at some press conference, and some reporter was like, said, "Hey, President Obama, what do you think of that there mosque they're going to build?" And it was like, it was that thing where they knew he was going to ask that at some point. And I read his full response, and it was actually I know that you shouldn't be surprised by this, but it was one of those things that was taken totally out of context, because his response was, unsurprisingly, I guess, very like calm and reasoned and measured. And he actually said, as long as they are following all laws and zoning ordinances, there is no reason in the United States why they shouldn't be allowed to put up a structure if it's not illegal under New York law. And it was almost like he answered like a lawyer. I mean, which is exactly how you want it. He just said, look, if New York City zoning and building regulations say it's legal, who is the government to tell them they can't do it? Which you think is exactly what people want, right? You know, who's the government to tell you what you can or can't build if it's property you own and if you're not breaking the law? But anyway, so because of that, apparently, though, Muslim.
Muslim. To clear it up at all, Obama is the Christian son of a Kenyan Muslim father and his mother, who's from Kansas. From the age of 6 to 10, Obama lived in a predominantly Muslim country, Indonesia, with his mother and his Indonesian stepfather. His full name, Barack Hussein Obama, sounds Muslim to some people. Evangelist Franklin Graham...
That's Billy Graham's son.
Says the president was born a Muslim, and because the seed is passed through the father. You have a...
The seed is passed through the father?
That's what he said.
Somebody was kept out of health class.
So that would be your third.
Let's see if Franklin Graham is crazy.
It's obvious that the president has renounced the prophet Muhammad, and he has renounced Islam, and he has accepted Jesus Christ. That's what he says he has done. I cannot say that he hasn't. So I just have to believe the president is what he has said.
Boy, that's... Well, you want to talk about a guy who's just a dick. All right. Wait, can you unplug that for a second? That thing you just...
Sorry.
All right, now plug it back in. That's odd. How even with your computer, your computer is actually so noisy that even with it actually turned down all the way, it just generates all kinds of bizarre sounds.
Sorry.
Well, I'm just... No, it's not your fault. Look, somebody's defensive. I'm not saying you built the thing. Listen to what a dick this guy is, though, that he's just, well, I guess if he says he's a Christian, we have no choice but to believe him. Huge dramatic eye roll. All right. Do we have one more from
this guy? Yeah, we do. He says that he believes it has to do with the president's lineage.
All right.
I think the president's problem is that he was born a Muslim. His father was a Muslim. The seed of Islam is passed through the father, like the seed of Judaism is passed through the mother. He was born a Muslim. His father gave him an Islamic name.
Whatever. I don't care. It just doesn't matter to me at all.
No.
So there you go. All right. Yeah. And this is all true. You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up here in just a bit, we're going to talk to Mr. Brett Burmeister. He is a Portland blogger. He writes about food carts. We've also got the Hick Watch on the way later on, Job Watch on the way. Today's pop culture authority coming up in the next hour. We'll talk about the phrase balls to the wall and what that means. This is Dawn Taylor.
I'm going to share with you your Stupid Criminal of the Week.
Here's the inaugural edition of your Stupid Criminal of the Week right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. All right, I've got you potted up over there.
Why, thank you very much. This is Stupid Criminal of the Week brought to you by mugshotlist.com.
Fantastic.
A Lake Oswego man pleaded guilty to methamphetamine charges Thursday after, well, let me just tell you the story. Alara Delonde was driving south on Highway 217 near Denny Road yesterday, when she saw in her rearview mirror a car driving very close to her bumper. Delon said she was driving around 55 miles per hour, but this fellow, Mark Antons, drove up really close to her bumper and began gesturing.
I was really concerned about his driving behavior, and it wasn't the normal tailgating. It was very, very close to my car.
So she said Antons continued with the gestures, then sped past her on the right, and blew by a police officer while in a construction zone. Delon knew that Antons had no idea that she was an undercover Beaverton police officer.
Oh, fail.
Where are we here? There we go.
Now today in court, Mark,
I asked him for his driver's license and insurance, and he gave me his Oregon department.
That wasn't it. Hold on. Here we go.
I'm in an unmarked police car, and I look like soccer mom.
So she did what she was supposed to do. She works in the fraud department, by the way, and has only ever made one traffic stop before in her career.
Awesome.
She flipped on her lights and sirens and pulled over Antons.
I asked him for his driver's license and insurance, and he gave me his Oregon Department of Corrections inmate card.
Turns out he was driving without a license and without insurance.
Yeah, so this, of course, no license, no insurance, gave her his Department of Inmates card. She had no choice but to tow his car. While searching the vehicle, she found nearly 15 grams of methamphetamine.
That's awesome.
Mark Antons is expected to spend almost 2 years in jail, which makes him our Stupid Criminal of the Week.
There you go. Stupid Criminal of the Week brought to you by the fine folks at mugshotlist.com. Mugshotlist.com. There you go. All right, coming up, we have a Hick Watch, a Job Watch, Pop Culture Authority, and Mr. Brett Burmeister talking about food carts. That'll be just around the corner on the other side. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program right here on the Emerson News Network. Stay there. hello to you. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program on the Emerson News Network. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. You can email Rick at rickemerson.com. Coming up later on today, we have our Hick Watch Job Watch on the way as well, and Pop Culture Authority. Today's installment of Pop Culture Authority answers the magical musical question, what is up with the phrase balls to the wall? The answer may surprise you. It's all on the way. Dawn Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you as well on your Friday afternoon.
Hey, Princess's horse dies during the Canby Rodeo. The recall of tainted eggs has expanded. And a man is mauled by a bear.
Excellent. Fantastic. Wait, is it just a single man and a single bear?
Yes.
All right. Awesome. Can I tell you what I did yesterday? Is I went home and I watched that video of the bull jumping into the stands during the bullfight, like 75 times in a row.
Yeah.
I just sat there like an idiot, giggling aloud to myself every single time I viewed it. It was really the highlight of my every time. You find yourself in any sort of a funk at some point today, or maybe you just you feel there's some sort of a black cloud hanging overhead. You can't quite break the grip of depression or some sort of an ennui that seems to have you in its unshakable grasp.
You think there's no fairness in the world,
seriously?
And that the little guy never gets a little bit back before he's taken to the dog food plant.
You watch that, man. He's just gonna give you a whole. It'll give you a whole different spring in your step. Can you do me a huge favor and unplug that?
Sorry.
Thank you. That'll be
there
awesome.
There we go.
All right.
Sorry
there you go.
That.
All right. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Let's now welcome to the Rick Emerson Show from foodcartsportland.com. Foodcartsportland.com. Mr. Brett Burmeister. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So you are a you write about food carts, and I'm not going to pretend that I'm old school Brett Burmeister, and that I've been following you since you were kid. I've been tracking your career forever. Our sort of chief of staff, Cheryl Kanakoa, was talking about you, and she recommended that we have you on the show because we'd heard a lot of other people who would talk to you, and that you would, you were sort of like the food cart Jedi in many ways of Portland. So when somebody goes to your site, first of all, what do they get? Is it reviews, or is it recommendations, or is it interviews with the people who run the actual cart, or is it just a discussion of the sort of the business end of it? What is your bailiwick, sir?
We kind of do all that. Mostly we're a guide to the food carts right now, and not a review site. We try not to do critical reviews. But what we have up there are profiles of all the different carts, their hours, their menu, their location, et cetera. And our goal really is to promote the story of the cart, not necessarily just what they're serving, but maybe the story behind the owner. Why did they get into it? What's this kind of food? Korean fusion food. What is that? And we try to tell that story.
So what's sort of jumping off the page at you right now? What's the last place you went to where it was either the food or the people who run it or the particular angle that they're taking that sort of leapt out at you as being interesting?
Well, I just ate at a Celtic cart called Celtic Corner that just showed up Monday or Tuesday down on Southwest 3rd and Oak. And they served Celtic food.
Is that where it tastes like Visigoth? Or what is the... What is Celtic food? Dawn Taylor in the back, you go to Ren Fairs. What's Celtic food?
I don't know. I'm thinking sausages inside of other things.
Yes.
And like mashed potatoes. Well, I'm thinking bangers and mashed potatoes. Sausages, like toad in a hole, sausage in a...
Oh, it's sort of like, so it's just like a so it's like a European kind of a...
Well, the Celtic thing would be your Scottish and Irish primarily.
All right, see, Dawn went to
school.
Yeah,
so they had like a Scotch egg on there, which is a hard-boiled egg wrapped in...
Oh, I know.
Sausage,
now you're speaking my language. Now you're talking the way Rick Emerson likes to hear you talk.
Yeah.
At the Rose and Thistle, they have the Scotch egg. We'll tell you right now. I don't know if there's a God or a heaven, but there is some sort of benevolent force in the universe that created the Scotch egg, because that's one of the best things that I've ever had in my entire life. I could just sit and shove that thing into my mouth all day till my heart exploded, because it's fantastic. Is it good, too? I mean, the way they make it?
Yeah. I didn't try the Scotch egg. I tried the sausage roll, which was sausage wrapped in phyllo dough. So, I mean, you can't go wrong with that.
No,
it's pretty,
you really can't.
Pretty good.
Really, if you put here's the thing I've learned is if you put meat in like another kind of meat, or if you just put meat inside some other substance, which is in and of itself fattening or filled with butter or lard, that is the way to the hearts of 98% of all thinking people.
Yeah, have you ever had the porchetta sandwich from the People's Pig?
No.
It's a pork loin that is then seasoned and then baked inside pork belly. So it's essentially pork inside bacon.
Wow.
Pork wrapped with bacon and then put on a roll.
How is it that you're not just huge? You don't weigh 500 pounds.
I don't know. I eat at the carts usually for lunch and on the weekends, and then I'm a vegetarian every other meal.
Is that true, really?
essentially, yeah.
You're a vegetarian. Well, I was going to say not on principle, because if you was a vegetarian, if it was some animal thing, some animal rights thing, you probably wouldn't be doing this. Were you a vegetarian most of your life, and then you just started doing this? In other words, have you written about food for a long time at other guises, or is this the first foray into that for you?
Yeah, this is my first foray into working in food or doing any type of food writing. I have written for about 6 or 7 years, mostly on blogs. I'm a vegetarian. I married into it. And so, when one person in the house is a vegetarian, you decide
that's the way everybody goes.
Yeah. So the food cart gig is really an excuse then to
baby, it's for work.
I got to eat pork wrapped in pork.
I didn't even enjoy it. I was thinking of you the whole time.
Yeah. And it's a lot of we have a roommate now, and he eats very well. He got to eat steak and kidney pie last night.
Wow.
Tuesday he got carnitas tacos, and one weekend he got some bacon wrapped hot dogs. So
damn it!
I just can't eat it all.
I'm looking at your site here, and I'm just like, oh man, I didn't realize there was a cart that specializes in Frito pie.
Yeah. Yep.
Where at?
32nd and Hawthorne.
Really?
Yeah. It's called Chili Pie Palace.
Wait, hold on. 32nd and Hawthorne. So I'm mentally. I'm trying to figure out if I've gone by that. So that'd be sort of by like Showcase Music or in that general area.
Yeah, just before Showcase.
They specialize in Frito pie.
Yeah, that was one of those things. The little hometown fair in my hometown where I grew up, Manhattan Beach. There was always a booth there every year that did Frito pie, and that was like the highlight of my year was going to the place to get the cut open bag of Fritos with the chili and the cheese and. Oh, see, I'm going to
One of the things that my mom used to make when I was growing up is she would make tamale pie, which then I would tell friends about it when I was an adult, and they all thought that I was making it up, that it was a fabricated dish, until then, to my pride/horror, I saw it on King of the Hill one night, where Peggy comes out of the kitchen and goes, I brought you tamale pie, and that sparked a whole discussion about things like that. We have some friends of ours, Lisa and Brian, run Big Ass Sandwiches, and they actually, I think they just won, it was the Willamette poll for best food cart or something. Are you seeing a lot of people who have gotten into food carts because whatever they were doing before just didn't work out, and they either left their previous gig because the economy turned on them, or they just wanted to do something else? I mean, why do most people get into the food cart thing?
Well, historically, it was because there was an ethnic flair to it, a family or, immigrants trying to just start something new, and a food cart was an easy way to do it. Mexican carts, Thai carts, etc. That's how the Bosnian cart started. Ziba just decided, I know how to cook and you know how to eat, and that's what we do. So lately there has been a significant growth, and a lot of the people that are opening carts, they do have these ambitions of, I've always wanted to do this. I was working in a restaurant. I was working in a bar. Here's my opportunity.
How much does it cost to open one of these? If I'm just some guy like me, if I don't know anybody, I don't have any connections, I don't have any hookup, and I say, by God, I'm going to open a cart tomorrow to serve whatever, what's it going to cost me?
$25,000 to $50,000.
And so where do most people get that money? Can you get a loan for that?
There's Mercy Corps Northwest is actually doing micro lending, which would allow you to get a small loan, or you can, go to your credit cards. I don't know if traditional banks or credit unions are doing food cart loans.
So you go and you get the cart, and I don't even know where you get the cart from. I mean, it sounds like a dumb question, but I mean, if you just go online or you just go to, is there like a catalog or something?
Nah, a year and a half ago, it was that easy. You could go to Craigslist and find them.
But they're all gone now.
Yeah, they're all gone. So there's a company, NMK, that is at Northwest Mobile Kitchens, actually building carts from scratch, along with a few other companies here in Portland that are either converting carts from scratch but converting a trailer or converting just anything you want with a kitchen in it for a price. Or like Chili Pie Palace, they have a vintage Aloha trailer, you know, one of those hunting trailers from the 60s that they are using the kitchen in it, and it's legal, you know.
So you go and you get the actual trailer itself, and you get the cart, and it's all you get the equipment and your whatever, and then are you renting when you go to put it up? Are you renting space from like the city or from a guy who owns the lot? I'm never clear about how a food cart ends up in a particular location.
Yeah, most of the food carts that are available at any given time, they're on private property. So downtown, they're all in the parking lots owned by City Center Parking. So they're just renting a spot anywhere between $450 and $650 a month. On the east side, they're all mostly private developers or private lot owners. Same thing. You know, they're for a certain amount of money, you get a certain amount of services. Like Mississippi Marketplace, I think, is a little bit more expensive because it's kind of a more premier space because it has a bar next to it called Prost. And so I think they pay a little bit premium, but it's also a very, very clean, nice space. So versus, you know, some of the lots downtown, which have an air of, well, there's cars there, there's
right.
the garbage cans fill up, things like that. So it's a different aesthetic for the cart owner. So a cart owner just has to go out and find a lot, and then they pay the landowner. If you want to put your cart on a city space, like on the sidewalk, or like in Pioneer Cross Square, there are carts in there. You do have to work with either the Parks Division or the city.
Do you have to get like special licenses to operate this? Or I mean, because you hear about all the paperwork required to do a kitchen, like an actual restaurant. How it's just red tape from miles. Is it the same thing with a food cart?
It's not as robust because it's not a physical location, so you don't have to do some of the things. But you work through Multnomah County. Exclusively, or I think Washington County, if you're in that area. And they provide your health code inspection and your health permit, and you pay them, I think it's $350 a year. There is a business license you have to buy from the city of Portland, but they don't come and talk to you. They just want your money. And that's $100 or $150, and you're up and running.
So what happens when winter comes? Is it going to be – I mean, people obviously got to eat during winter as well, but it seems so much of this is like walk-up business or people who are – they're out late at the bar and they're, you know, it's midnight and they leave and they want a taco or something. They're walking down the street with their friends. When winter comes, is it going to be driving some of these folks out of business?
That was the question we asked last summer. When we saw a 30% growth in 2009, we were like, huh, we'll see it shake out in the winter, 2009, 2010. And then over the winter from September into March, we saw another 30% growth. Big Ass Sandwiches opened up in December.
Yeah, that's true.
And became the number one cart and have always been busy. So perfect success stories. In the past year and a half, I've only seen three or four carts close.
Is there anything that we either, in terms of food, the food carts, we either got too much of or not enough of? In other words, is there some, because for a while we were just like lousy with Thai places, whereas like everywhere you went, and I'm not talking about food carts, like restaurants, it's like you're tripping over a Thai restaurant. Are we overpopulated with some kind of food, and is there some kind of food that's just not present at all?
I did some stats, and we do have a lot of Mexican trucks, and we have a lot of Thai trucks. That they make up about 15 to 20% of the total carts. I joked one time with the AP, it's not what do we have, it's what don't we have. And I don't think we have a cart serving Chilean food, but I may be wrong. I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where we have carts covering almost everything. We have a Mongolian cart. It's not regular, but he does show up at events. We have a cart that does Himalayan food. Again, they show up at Sunday Parkways. They're not a regular cart that you can find it during the day. But I think really that what we're looking at right now is either twists on the old favorite. For example, the Chili Pie. Chili Pie Palace opened 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and another chili place just opened last week. And they have a chili pie, but their focus is mostly on chili, just true Texas chili. We still have a growth in Thai carts. There's a new Thai cart opening, it seems, every week, but they're changing it up. Instead of the traditional Thai carts that we've had that have done the pad Thai or pad Khmer Mao, the noodles, we're now getting northern Thai cuisine. They're changing the ingredients and proposing a different flavor profile for us.
All
or
right.
You got something simple like Nong's Kamangai, which is just chicken and rice.
Here's the thing, you bastard. You're going to have to start bringing food with you if you come on the show again, because all we've had this – let me just say this. This can of Vizo, this is the –
entirety of what I've had to eat today. Dawn, meanwhile, comes in today, and not only does she turn down blackberry cobbler from downstairs. It was like freshly, it sounds like it was freshly made, like right out of the oven or something. Do you want some warm blackberry cobbler? She turns it down and then tells me about it in excruciating detail so I can just sit here and salivate like a savage. And then you're eating a cold hot dog in front of me. So it's just...
I like cold hot dogs.
I just feel like one of those guys, you know, who's in Sing Sing, and I've got pictures of, like, Vandekamp's pork and beans on my cell wall, and I just stare at it longingly. So I'm telling you, the next time you got it. And the other thing about the food carts is, because it's so much of it, it's like in New York, you know, it's so much food that you can grab and that you can take with you without having to stop and sit, because there's nothing to sit there, and you don't want to be spilling stuff on you and whatever. And that's the other great thing is people have figured out a way to take a food that would be messy or that would nominally require a table and then stick it into some form where you can just carry it with you. It's like sticking stuff into a cone.
Yeah, there's a great picture here on the front page of your site, Food Carts Portland, with fried chicken from the Swamp Shack. And you got like this lovely little easy-to-carry tray, and you got a couple of delicious-looking pieces of fried chicken, a little corn, a little mashed potatoes,
and
some gravy.
Some amazing fried chicken.
Oh, man. Hey, what is your – this isn't really a food cart as such. What's your take on that grilled cheese grill place?
I love it.
Really?
Yeah.
I went there. I never thought I would say this, but I've gone there twice, and it's just all it's just almost too much cheese. It's always like my body sort of rebels. It's the thing, and I really do. It's not that it's bad. It's really good, but it's I think maybe that I get about halfway through it, and there's some force inside my body that just says, "Look, man, you have to slow down. You have to stop." Have you gone there?
No.
Oh, the grilled cheese grill. It's really good, but you got to like, I think you got to eat slowly because that thing where your brain takes 10 minutes or whatever to register that you're full. And it's like, it was like three kinds of cheese and then cream cheese and then jalapenos and then like some more cheese. Then it just all cooked down. It was great. But
see, this mental block. It's like peanut butter and Ellie's or something. It's like I have this sort of block about going to a restaurant and paying restaurant prices for
something
a
you could
grilled
make.
Cheese sandwich or a peanut. Ah, that's the thing. So I was going to ask, because from your viewpoint, your purview as like, you know, the guy who's now sampling all the food carts and looking all the way. In just some sort of, I guess, generalized sense, or be specific as you want, what makes for ideal cart food? What works the best?
You know, initially I would have agreed that it was something simple like a hot dog on a bun or a very simple rice and, you know, bento, because that's really what I grew up on in the 90s when the first forays into eating at food carts. But I've also been introduced to escargot from a food cart, and they did it very, very well. And so it told me and kind of taught me that you can pretty much do anything you want from a food cart if you do it very well. And that's the key. One of the things I tell burgeoning food cart owners or people who want to be a food cart owner, listen, is pick something that you do very well that you love and you don't mind even eating it
right
every day and do it. And just do that. Don't try to have an expansive menu, because then you'll diminish or you'll lessen the value of what you do so well. And the perfect example is Potato Champion. He does fries.
Yeah.
He does fries so well that he's the guy that does fries.
It is actually – it's such a good point, because that is not the guy that I think of whenever I – because I have a whole thing for French fries. And good or bad French fries, it's not that it makes or break a restaurant, but they're hard to do sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so at any given time – like there's that place, that restaurant, Carafe, that I love Carafe, and they have fantastic French fries. But they have sort of been usurped in my mind by the Potato Champion guy, because he has the niche. And it's the same lesson that Apple computing, Apple computers learned, where you have the applicant, you have the one thing that does a specific job better than anything else.
Well,
and that's what Potato Champion
Whiffies
does.
Whiffies is the same way. You know, it's like we make the dough, we put something in the middle of the dough, we fold it over and crimp it, and we make fried pies. And they make a bunch of different kinds of fried pies, but that's it. They do fried pies quite well, and people love Whiffies.
Yeah, yeah. If I could go to that place that without it being just some hippie-filled rave, you know, after 9 p.m. or something, that would be awesome. If
hippies?
I could go, no, have you ever been?
Hipsters.
This is a bunch of people twirling in a circle like they're around some sort of Jimi Hendrix style maypole that only they can see.
Have you been there for Dragon Tarot?
No. What?
Yeah, there's a woman who does tarot card reading, but with dragon cards.
I got to find somewhere else to go. I have to move to a different part of town. All right. So the website is Food Carts Portland. That is just like it sounds, all one word. Foodcartsportland.com or facebook.com/foodcartsportland or on Twitter, PDX food carts. PDX food parts. All right. So if you were going to make a, if you were going to open your own food cart right now, and well, you maybe you have plans to, maybe you don't. What would you, if you were to open tomorrow, what would you do?
You know, I my friends and I joke about we just open a cart. What drunk people like to eat.
Well, that's. I mean, that, you and, could. There are worse things than to give drunks what they want.
And deep fried.
Yeah.
So you know, deep fried hot dogs, deep fried, you know, fries, all kinds of things. But you know, mix it up, have a special every day.
Excellent.
You know, I don't have a goal of opening a food cart. I like to cook, but I don't know if I could do it to the level of quality that I have experienced. And I'd always feel like it would be a competition because there are some amazing people out there. I mean, like I mentioned, People's Pig, that's Cliff Allen. He was a sous chef or assistant chef at Nostrana. Wow. And he decided to leave Nostrana to open a food cart. That's amazing. And we have that available to us anytime during the day.
One, it's got to be, you know, and Don, you know, you've worked in the food industry for, you know, as a I don't even know. I would say chef or cook
mostly
or whatever.
Mostly as a pastry chef.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where you got to like not only love doing it, but you got to love food as well, because otherwise you're just going to hate it. Otherwise, yeah. After a while, it gets – because like any job that has stress or downside or whatever, the upside has to be significant enough that you can tolerate all of the crap that goes along with it. You really have to just love – you know, is it the lifestyle? But you have to love the whole thing about it. And I think if somebody just sees it and they just look at it as like a cash grab – you know, oh, the money's all in food carts. That's what it'll do. You know, Ira, get a food cart. We'll go sell something. Is it? Your, I mean, you're going to last like a month, and then you're just going to bail out of it because it seems like it is a thing that requires you to really, really be dedicated, and that requires actually loving what you do.
And it's also incredibly hard work.
Well, it is.
Being a chef is or a cook or a chef is really, really physically hard work to begin with, and then it's like it seems to me the food cart experience in many cases is even more so. So I watch like Lisa and Brian, and in most of your cooking jobs, you have a certain amount of downtime. But if you have a busy food cart, you're pretty much busy from the moment you open until you close,
Jesus.
And you're in this tiny little enclosed hot space all day long.
Christ, there's Brian and Lisa were telling us about they were here last week or so, and they were talking about, I forget the period of time, but it was like whether it was a day or a week or whatever it was, but there was something where they had like there was some special they were running or whatever, and they'd planned on making, I don't know, over the course of however long this was, of selling like 500 sandwiches or something. They sold like 3,500 of them. And they were just – and they had that look on their face like they just wanted you to put a bullet in the back of their heads when it was over, you know, which is a good problem to have. But, I mean, it'll run you ragged. It really will. I do say actually just not to end on a downer note or whatever, but the one thing – I really do wish – we've talked a lot in the past on the show about Scott Moritz, who was the guy who founded Salvador Mali's and Secret Aardvark, Secret Aardvark Trading Company. You know, I wish that he was still here. I wish he was still around to see what has happened because, you know, that whole thing started as a food cart with just him. And it really is – I mean, it's just – do you know the percent of increase that we've had in food carts? Do you know how, from what number to what number in the last 2 years?
So in November of 2009, we got a number from the county of 479, and we're at 600 now.
Wow.
So about a 30% to 40% increase in a year. 2000, and then they said in 2009 it was a 30% increase, added 200 carts in 2009, and we've added another 160 or 180 just this year.
Mm. And what's really awesome about that, just saying as a consumer – most of that food is really good.
And that's the thing, is it? It's all. I don't think I've been to a food cart yet where I just go, ah, this is dreck. You know, it's all okay. It's all decent. And some of it is exceptional. Some of it is fantastic. There's the last thing, we're so way over time, but my, there's the Potato Champion, and then which is where Whiffy's is, and then across the lot, shares the back wall with Tiny's, I guess, is it's like a poor boy place.
Bubba Bernie's.
Yeah. And it's, I forget if this is the guy I was talking to, but I think he might be the guy where he was like a software designer or something, and then he was just like, and then one day I just said, screw it, or whatever, but he's a guy who just loved to cook, and it's that thing where you get like the big sausage with the bacon and the whatever, and it's in the thing, and you're eating it, and it really is just one of life's, it is one of life's golden moments of sublimity where you're just having that, and you're at the bench, and you're under the sky, and if the weather is nice, and you just, you know, it really is just a perfect, it is a quintessentially perfect, not just Portland moment, but a moment of just all good things. It is a confluence of all great things about being alive.
And somebody might be twirling next to you.
Yes. Try to go there during the day when they're sleeping it off. All right. Foodcartsportland.com is the website. Food carts, keep transposing that. Foodcartsportland.com. rickemerson.com. We'll put the link up at rickemerson.com as well. Brett McMurtry, we'll have to have you back, man.
Yes.
Thank you
so
much
for
joining us.
And I'll bring food.
Yes,
trust me.
Yes. Yes, you will. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Still to come, we have Hick Watch, Job Watch, and Pop Culture Authority all on the way. This is the Rick Emerson Show on the Emerson News Network. Don't go anywhere. We return after this. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us today. It's 503-505-6964. Brett Burmeister. That guy was cool. I dig him.
He was.
I'll have to have him back. And not just because of the food thing, but, you know.
I want one of those Frito pies.
You've never sounded more like a child. I want a Frito pie. Jesus.
And I want my chocolate-covered peanut butter bugles that you promised me.
Look, you know.
I even texted you before the show.
No, you didn't. Really?
Yes, I did. I texted. I sent you a text that said, I want bugles.
Oh, well, you know, I... Yeah, that's not helping the sounding like a child thing, by the way. If it makes you feel better, I didn't check my Black... I have this thing where, as relentless as I am, and I am one of those dicks who's on his BlackBerry all the time, I am relentless with the BlackBerry, except in the morning, where somehow, I think it's like a self-preservation thing. Maybe subconsciously I do, but my brain forgets that the BlackBerry exists until around noon. And I think that's because otherwise it would just, my morning would become chaotic instantly. So,
well, it's a good thing that that's not how I would contact you in case of, I don't know, some sort of emergency.
No, you have to. Well, you know, if you call me, like if you call me, the phone will ring.
Oh, okay.
But I guess that's the thing, is when I go to bed at night, I turn off all the sound on my BlackBerry. I mean, I take it into the bedroom because it's my alarm clock. But I turn off all the sound except for the phone. So if you were to call me and be like, you know, and say like, I'm bleeding by the side of the road, I'd probably hear that.
See, but I wasn't going to call you just to tell you I wanted to Google.
Because that would be pathetic.
Yes. Texting was much more dignified.
I'm just saying I wasn't ignoring your request for bugles. I didn't even see it. I wasn't ignoring it, though. But here's the upside, though, is I forgot the bugles, but I also forgot to bring the kombucha, which I was going to have all of us drink. You and me and Brett. He doesn't know that. You and me and Brett Burmeister, we were all going to drink kombucha together.
Well, is Ryan White coming in again on Monday?
Yes, he is.
Well, we can force kombucha on him.
We should do it to Aaron Mesh. His paper ran the big article
yeah.
about it. Let's punish that bastard. We'll make him drink something.
Yeah.
And then we'll all taste the colors with our mind. All
right. Need to make him come in here so that you can see his.
Me, I just did a thing. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
We need to bring Aaron Mesh in here so you can see his My Name is Earl mustache.
Yeah, I'm picturing it in my mind, but I don't know if it's anything like the reality. But you said that he had like a whole weird sort of.
I swear he looks just like Paul Rudd in Anchorman now.
Awesome. All right, ladies and gentlemen, what's that sound?
And now, from the news desk,
this
is Dawn Taylor.
Sam.
Rodeo princess Erica Roney lost her horse, Batty, last night during a royalty arena run of the Canby Rodeo. The 23-year-old horse suffered a cardiac arrest, said veterinarian Mike Harms. The horse died on the spot.
Oh, come on.
These cardiac events are very rare in horses, he said. Batty was a 20-year veteran of rodeo, 4-H, and equestrian events. The horse was doing what it was trained to do and wanted to be doing this evening. Arms
really?
Set.
Did the horse tell you that? Did the horse paw it on the ground? Hold on, Batty.
I'm happy,
Batty. If you'd like to be abused and exploited like an inanimate object for your entire life and never given a moment's peace, do nothing. All right, great. Have at it. Jesus, we have to have some sort of a limit on the number of animal mishap stories. Because we used to have like an absolute moratorium on that, where if anything unfortunate happened to an animal, we would never, ever, ever read those stories. A, because it puts people in a bad mood. And this is you know, I mean, whatever. But also because it just filled Tim with like an apoplectic, furious rage that he could not shake off for the rest of the day.
Well, I have the thing. In the morning, I spent a couple of hours in the morning gathering news for Legion of News and for this. And there's just these stories that I just, you know, like we just had a story here in Portland, just like I guess it was today.
If it's a horrible, please don't give me.
No, but
any
it was
details.
Like it was about cat torturing, and it was like, no, I don't want to read that. No, I'll get these things about like some kind of horrible molestation of a small child. It's like, you know, and it's like if this was KGW and I had to report that stuff, sure. But there's sometimes where it's just like, I think about that.
Well, and the only actual really, really, I think, dark story we've had maybe all week is that one that we had during Legion of News, which I only played because it was just so unbelievably weird, which is about the woman who was,
she
was assaulted, and then she ran down the guy with a car that she thought did it, and it was like some other guy altogether.
And even then, that story sounded kind of amusing. Until you heard her.
Yeah.
And then it was like,
God. I was just hoping to find some sort of explication as to how the whole thing unfolded. So anyway, with the rodeo, I would like to think that in his, you know, in the horse's last moments before it died of a cardiac arrest, that it was at least trying to throw her off to the ground and cripple her.
Get off of me. Get off.
If you would just give me a moment to, crap. All right. Here's Dawn Taylor.
The nationwide recall of tainted eggs expanded today as a second Iowa egg farm was linked to the ongoing investigation of a salmonella outbreak that's already sickened more than 1,000 people. Iowa's Hillendale Farm said Friday it was recalling its eggs after laboratory tests confirmed illnesses associated with them. The company did not say how many eggs were being recalled or if it is connected to Wright County Egg, another Iowa farm that recalled 380 million eggs earlier this week. An FDA spokeswoman said the two recalls are related. The strain of salmonella poisoning is the same strain linked to Wright County Egg.
Wait a minute. So I'm so unclear about this. How is it that I know if my eggs need to be taken back?
I mean,
is there some sort of a...
Do you want to know what the symptoms of salmonella are?
No. Well, I mean, I guess I feel fine, so I guess we're good. In other words, like, have they said, like, these are the, this is where it would have been sold?
Well, yeah, and these are, you know, in
so, like, Midwest
in
or something?
In the Midwest.
Oh, well,
our eggs here are not coming from
that's
it.
That's okay. As long as we in the left coast are immune, then that's fine.
It's not our problem.
It's a flyover problem. I said in the States, we're in the, nobody goes there anyway, no. You know? They're not really doing anything with those states.
Let's do our Hick Watch.
Speaking of flyover places, ladies and gentlemen, here is your, if I can actually find the opening, here we go. Here's your Hick Watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Copenhagen makes me feel so good. Copenhagen, the way I know it should. Well, I put a little chew in my mouth, go spitting, slobbering all around the house.
Hey-o.
Copenhagen makes me feel so good.
Here's your Hick Watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
A bear owned by a man who used to offer people the chance to wrestle the animals mauled its 24-year-old caretaker to death during a feeding on property containing other bears, many wolves, and perhaps lions and tigers.
It's like a Hick Watch meets a Darwin Watch.
The bear in the attack southwest of Cleveland was not one that owner Sam Mazzola used for wrestling, officials said, a practice that brought him the wrath of animal rights activists in 2006.
Excellent.
His license to exhibit animals had been revoked, but he apparently was still allowed to keep them on his property. The rescue squad took Mazzola from the attack scene Thursday night with an unspecified medical problem that Lorain County Sheriff's Captain James Drozdowski said was not from any injury. Mazzola later checked himself out of the hospital and was expected to return home. Brent Kandra died Friday morning at Metro Health Medical Center, the coroner's office in Cleveland said. He had been taken by medical helicopter after the Thursday evening attack in Columbia Township. The bear was out of its cage for its feeding, Drozdowski said, which was normal for this particular bear because the caretaker and the owner had been around it so much. Mazzola was able to get the bear back in its cage by using a fire extinguisher. We don't know whether something startled the bear or what prompted the bear to get aggressive with the caretaker, Drozdowski said. We do know it got aggressive with the caretaker and mauled him severely.
Maybe the bear decided it didn't need any caretaking. Maybe he decided he'd rather live a life of, what do you call that, freedom.
Maybe he realized that he was owned by a guy who used to promote bear wrestling.
Well, you see, that's the thing, though. You figure the bear would enjoy that part. Maybe the bear was angry. Well, maybe he was just frustrated that the wrestling was had been discontinued.
That's true.
You got to figure if you're a bear, because bears don't know from wrestling. You got to figure that when you're having somebody wrestle the bear tussle with the bear. The bear basically just is saying, like, hey, they're letting me fight with my food. That's awesome. You know, the bear just sort of views that as a, you know, little trip back home.
The property held about 7 to 9 bears and 20 wolves and possibly a lion and 3 or 4 tigers.
Now, but that doesn't make any sense. Are you wrestling with wolves, too?
No, he just has a whole lot of animals. I don't know.
They were
maybe
there.
He does have wolf wrestling.
You know,
I don't know.
Here's the thing about animal people, crazy animal people. Animal people are like... They're like hippies with bumper stickers. You know, you can have one, you can have two, but you know, you can't have 50.
Yeah, how many bears do you need?
And
really?
If you have 50, then you're just a crazy person. And that's what the animal hoarding types are all like.
Well, Raymond O'Leary, 76, a retired Cleveland police officer, lives around the corner from Mazzola's property. He said it was like living next to a zoo. He said it was worrisome knowing there were exotic animals in the neighborhood. It's a concern to all of us, he said. We can hear the animals in the evening at feeding time roaring over there.
Jesus Christ. That's got to be a unique brand of unnerving.
When he moved into the area 2 years ago, he said a neighbor showed him a video of a tiger loose on their street. They caught the tiger without incident, though, O'Leary said.
You would think that, well, maybe the realtor has motive not to tell you about that thing, actually.
There's a guy with a couple of animals.
How often does the tiger get loose? So often you won't even notice it. Don't you worry. Now, this is a real handyman's delight here, this place.
Just
Jesus
make sure you bring your cats in at night.
God damn. Did you, was it you that I was talking to about the pot growers and the bears?
Yeah.
So they're doing this amazing thing now. And you really got to give it up to drug dealers because they're a thing. Here's the thing about drug dealers and guys who especially are really at the top of their game in terms of growing or distributing or selling narcotics or whatever. That is the thing that if I was even reasonably certain that I could do it without going to prison, I wouldn't be here right now. I'd be selling narcotics. Let's have no illusions about that. I often joke about becoming some sort of new millennium pornographer, but really, drug selling is where Laura and I have had these discussions, like not seriously about doing it clearly, but I mean, where it just, you know, because everybody has gone through some phase in their life where either you know, either you yourself were experimenting with some sort of chemical to open your doors of consciousness, or you had a roommate or somebody who was buying, you know, drugs from some guy who would come by the house every now and again, and a guy who, like, maybe trembled a lot and drooled. And you would think to yourself, like, well, this is so dumb that anybody can do it and make money. Like, that guy can sell drugs because the product sort of sells itself. And you just say, you know, if this guy can do it, how hard can it be? And as long as I don't get caught, and then there's that.
See, and then there's your
that's
thing.
That's the thing. And the thing cycles through your head where you go, like, okay, well, do you think you could make enough money and then quit before you got caught? But then what you realize is that if you're like me, you know, a job worth doing is worth doing well. And it's not that I would be able to not be able to say no to the money after a while, though it might be difficult. I mean, if you're making a hand over fist, you know, income just by dealing narcotics, you might be tempted to keep doing it. But I will tie this back to bears here in a second. But also just because you got to figure that it's what they call the Peter Principle, which is that which was first postulated in the 50s. And the Peter Principle effectively states that every time you do a job without effing up, you are promoted into a position of greater authority. But the logical inevitability of that is you will eventually be promoted to a job you can't do. It's called rising to your level of incompetence, they called it. And so every time you do your job correctly, they'll give you more responsibility until eventually it's too much and everything will go wrong. Well,
that's how I ended up here.
And it's a blessed miracle of failing upward, Don. And so, you know, but that's the thing with dealing drugs, is that, like, you would start by just selling to your dirtbag roommates, then their friends, then those guys, then you sell them larger amounts, then you're selling a key, then you're wholesale, and then you're in prison for the rest of your life, you know, or you find yourself in the jungle in Colombia, you know, surrounded by skulls, not quite sure how you got there. But you do have to admire the fact that drug dealers, in their own weird way, are just exceptionally intelligent and motivated. I mean, they really are the cream of the intellectual crop in the business world in some sort of very rarefied niche kind of capacity.
Now, a certain strata of drug dealers.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But, you know, that's what I'm not talking about, the dirtbag guy in on your block who's just selling you skunk weed. So these guys had this huge weed-growing operation somewhere. I think it was here in the Northwest somewhere. It might have been Idaho. And the deal is that they had these, like, an acre or something of weed. And so what they would do is they would just leave a lot of food out to lure bears to the field of marijuana, because the bears aren't going to eat the weed, obviously. And so they would just start littering the place with food to train the bears to just come and sit by, you know, just sit there and just, you know, hang out in the marijuana field. And, you know, and then, you know, eventually if somebody comes to screw with them, they're just going to be, you know, whatever. They're just going to be stoned.
That would be in Canada.
Was it in Canada?
All right. Yeah, 14 black bears that they lured to basically guard their
awesome.
Their marijuana.
All right, here's your so that was your Hick Watch. And I was going to say, you know, when we were actually talking about with Peter Carlin yesterday, although I cannot remember if it was on the air or off because he was here for like 7 hours. There's your Hick Watch for Friday.
Copenhagen makes me feel so good. Copenhagen, the way I know it should. Well, I put a little chew. Go spitting, slobbering all around the house. That Copenhagen makes me feel so good.
So let's do a couple more here, and then we'll do and we'll have a word from one of our many sponsors here in just a few. We'll do today's Pop Culture Authority. Then we'll come back on the other side and wrap everything up. This is Don Taylor.
Spencer Pratt is writing a tell-all about his life with ex-wife Heidi Montag. I'm not holding anything back, The Hill's bad boy told Us Weekly, adding that he'll dish details about his plastic surgery-obsessed bride and her rocky relationship with her mother. The 23-year-old Montag, who ended their year-old marriage by filing for divorce in July, is trying to keep her name out of the news for a change and told TMZ she's looking into legal options to stop her former husband. This is exactly why I left him, she said. Pratt says, my last book, How to Be Famous, didn't make the New York Times bestseller list because it was in the self-help section, he said. This one's going to be totally different.
He seems like a guy that I ought to like because he's just so completely shameless. But I just I lack some sort of a chromosomal switch to do so.
All of these people, though, their delusional sense of self-importance is just mind-boggling.
I guess, except at the same time, you got to look at that guy and say, well, he's gotten at least two book deals. And he's been on at least five television programs that I could think of. So, you know, and he was spent a long time, banging Heidi Montag. So, you know, it's Maybe it's not a delusional sense of importance is my thing with that guy. I'm not saying that he's going to be remembered in 100 years, but what does he care?
Yeah, I find myself just hoping that there will be some moment of self-awareness, probably in about 20, 30 years when he's aging badly, in his 40s and early 50s, and all of a sudden perhaps there will be a moment when the light bulb will go on over his head and when he'll realize, hey, wait a minute, I'm just a big douchebag.
No, but the thing is, I don't think he would disagree with that assessment now. I think if you were to tell him that now, he'd be like, yeah, I'm a douchebag with a book deal. And then he'd just, bam. And then he's, what he is?
I think that gives him credit for a little more intelligence than he actually has.
I think he may be a guy who, how do I put this? I think that deep inside, in his heart, you say that, well, deep inside, he knows that he is unimportant and he knows he's a dick. I don't think it's that. I think it's that deep, deep inside, he really honestly has a fantastic opinion of himself and believes himself to be awesome in every conceivable way. Mm-hmm. But then he does that sort of exterior of the, hey, I'm just a douche who got lucky, but I got lucky to the tune of $3 million or whatever. And so I just don't even know how much self-awareness a guy's ever going to get, because I think that it's like, what it is? It's like in, I believe it was Life, the Universe, and Everything. It was one of the Hitchhiker's original trilogy books where they take Zaphod Beeblebrox, who is the on-the-run president of the universe, and they try to break his will by putting him in something called the Infinite Perspective Vortex. And the Infinite Perspective Vortex is designed to be a brainwashing aid by completely snapping your willpower and your mental state. And the way that it does so is it's like a phone booth, and you put him in. You put somebody into the Infinite Perspective Vortex, and then it shows you the entirety of creation. It shows you the entire universe, the galaxy, all of the known worlds. And then it zooms in and it shows you your place in it, and it's so infinitesimally small that it just snaps your mind in half. But the thing is, they put Zaphod in there, and then he comes out and he's just fine. He's like, hey, it showed me that I'm the most important thing in the entire galaxy. Hey, and it's that's what I think Spencer Pratt is. I think I don't think there's any way that you could say anything harmful to that guy, because I think there's like one moving part in his head, and it's the part that says, you rule, and that's it. So, whatever. I think really the only thing that's going to help is when somebody sets him on fire.
Elsewhere.
Don't do that, by the way.
The Associated Press, one of the world's most powerful news organizations, issued a memo today advising its staff to avoid the phrase Ground Zero Musk. It was reported Tuesday that the AP started using the phrase Ground Zero Musk in some headlines in late May. The New York Times, for one, has consciously avoided that phrasing. The AP began using the phrase as the controversy over the proposed Islamic Cultural Center and mosque in Lower Manhattan began bubbling up at the national level. Many news organizations across platforms routinely dubbed the project the Ground Zero Mosque. The AP has always been clear in the text of the stories that the project would be built two blocks from Ground Zero and not on the actual site. But AP headlines at times ran with the phrase adopted by opponents of the project and amplified by the media. Now the news organization is taking steps to make sure that it no longer occurs. We should continue to avoid the phrase Ground Zero Mosque or Mosque at Ground Zero on all platforms.
Well, how are they referring to it? I would call it that at this point, just because otherwise people are not going to know what you're talking about. It's just that, you use that phrase because it's a shorthand that explains the thrust of the story.
Tom Kent, the AP's deputy managing editor of Standards and Production, he has advised some different ways they could refer to it in short headlines as Mosque Two Blocks from WTC Site, Muslim or Islamic Center near WTC Site, Mosque near Ground Zero, and Mosque near WTC Site. Because Mosque at Ground Zero is incorrect.
Yeah, well, I guess, but then again, maybe, or not, depending. Because there's no definition of what Ground Zero is. That's the thing. It's like,
Well, it is something very specific. The World Trade Center was.
I think if you were standing two blocks away and you said, well, I was basically at Ground Zero when that happened, I don't think anybody would quibble with you.
I think that's the whole point of something being Ground Zero is it's the spot.
Yeah.
That's why it's called Ground Zero.
I guess, but that means spot. If I'm 10 feet away, I'm not at the Ground Zero. But everybody, colloquially speaking, I'm just saying that this is the thing where the AP – look, I don't care. I'm just saying it's where the – I think it's where the AP is just being persnickety. I think they're just trying to – I think that they are just trying to – I think they're trying to look a little bit more righteous than they actually are.
Personally, I think they should also avoid calling it a mosque, although Kent says that they can refer to it.
Is it not a mosque?
No, it's a cultural center, although they – there are prayer services and some things that involve prayers that go on there. So technically, it can be referred to as a mosque, but actually, it's a cultural center. It has it's a multi-level, multi-story building that will have a number of things that happen there, rather than just being a mosque.
I like how technically it's a mosque, but we can't call it that.
And well,
but then you're like a stickler for the Ground Zero thing. Technically, it's not at Ground Zero, so it's not Ground Zero.
Well, it's not technically a church any more than if you had, like, say, a Christian cultural center where you also had, like, say, a room where there were some services
right.
that were held. You still wouldn't call that building a church.
I might if I was trying to inflame people, which is really what I'm trying to do here. That's really – I'm just for whatever causes disagreement.
It's a building it has a swimming pool, a gym. It has other facilities. Muslim services have been held there in the building since 2009, but it – you know, it's more than just a mosque. It's a cultural center.
I hope they build it. I'm just going to go get my picture taken there. That is going to be the first place I go the next time I go to New York. I'm going to go get my picture taken, just give it a big thumbs up in front of the Ground Zero Mosque. I don't care. I don't give a rip. And so forth. All right.
Richard Bales, retired. Retarded baseball star Roger Clemens has been indicted on numerous charges related to testimony he gave to a congressional committee. A federal grand jury has charged the 7-time Cy Young winner with perjury, obstruction of Congress, and making false statements over the insistence to a House committee that he never used steroids or human growth hormone. David Epstein with Sports Illustrated says this will make for an interesting 2013 Hall of Fame voting year.
Both he and Barry Bonds will be eligible for the first time. They're both currently indicted on perjury charges. And they're the best pitcher and the best hitter of their era. So that's going to be kind of keep this debate going at least through 2013 in a big, big way.
That's awesome how it's like the leader in every single scoring category in baseball is somehow ineligible for the Hall of Fame. I mean, goddamn Pete Rose has been like banned for life or whatever because he was gambling on sports, including on his own team. And then you've got Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens. So it, apparently whoever's number two in any sort of any sort of competitive scoring aspect or achievement aspect of baseball has got to be feeling really good because it's just a matter of time till the number one guy, they find out that he's been running the numbers on Fleet Street or something, and then they take him out of eligibility.
Epstein says Clemens' legacy is important to him.
He's always had the legacy of a guy who can stand up on the mound, be an intimidator, and get people to back down. And it seems like he kind of took the same approach in this case, and it didn't really work out that well because he was facing Congress and law enforcement officials and not, you know, scared batters who were shaking in their cleats.
So I wonder if this is a thing where he's been found like he has done steroids or if they're just trying to get him to say that he did and he denies it or whatever. Because that was the thing with was it Barry Bonds that I'm thinking of? Is that a thing where like it was where he finally copped to it? I think it was Barry Bonds where it's like all that really ever came to it was like his trainer or some guy that worked with him said it was the case. But I don't think like he ever was found to it. It's like with Lance Armstrong where they're always saying that Lance Armstrong has been doped up on something.
I don't understand why at this point we care.
Well, I don't care.
These guys are just, multimillionaire trained monkeys, basically, that do one thing for our entertainment. So if they want to, like, pump themselves full of steroids so they can hit the ball farther and provide more entertainment for us, just make it legal for all of them to do it if they want to. I don't care if they're damaging their health. None of us really care if they're damaging their health. I realize that the argument is that it's, like, a bad role model for the youth and that sort of thing. But honestly, it's like I think that, if you actually educate people on how dangerous steroids are and then just say, but these guys do it because, something, they're trained monkeys for our amusement, then, let's just let them do it. Just let them hit the ball farther, run faster, bulk themselves up to some ridiculous amount, and we'll pay them $5 million, and we'll still, like, watch their little game.
And let's be honest, it's not like being a pro athlete is really a ticket to longevity and health anyway. I mean, have you ever, in my life, and, nobody exceptionally famous, but I've met a couple, like, NFL guys or whatever, and it's like they're all 35 years of age, and they're just, like, bent over a cane and just sort of limping along down a hallway, and, they're terrified that they're going to bump into something and shatter what remains of their bones. So, you know, really, who cares? I mean, it doesn't really, I'm just glad that they don't have these sort of regulations for, like, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Can you imagine if they just allegations that the Beatles, in fact, enhanced their songwriting abilities by use of hallucinogens has sparked calls for their removal from the Rock Hall of Fame?
Yeah, if there's some kind of ethics clause for the Rock and Roll Hall of, Hall of Fame.
Meanwhile, you've got, like, the Osmonds who are sitting there, you know, screaming that it's unfair because they didn't expand their consciousness the same way Brian Wilson did. And so, therefore, of course, they were overmatched by the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds album. Jeez Christ. Do we have one more of these?
Yeah. Paul Callan, professor of media studies at Seton Hall University, says Clemens is hurting his case by being vocal about it on Twitter.
Roger Clemens is answering fan questions on Twitter. That's all going to be used against him by prosecutors when he takes the stand at trial. He's a nightmare client for a defense attorney.
Awesome. I like anybody who's a nightmare client.
What an idiot. Like
that's fantastic. All right. There you go. So, I have no segue. I have nothing. Except, let me ask you this, John Taylor.
Yes.
Do you know what the IICRC could be? I'll give you the last word. It's certification. It's a thing you receive if you're like a cleaning company. Let's say like the cleaning solution.
IICRC, the International Institute.
The first word is institute. This is like Password or Family Feud.
The Institute of Irrationally Retarded Cleaning.
No,
I don't know.
No, cleaning. You got that? Here's the thing. You actually got 3 out of 5. Even without really trying. That's how skilled you are.
Woo-hoo!
It is the Institute of Inspection.
Do I win bugles?
It is the Institute. You know, here's the thing. I'm doing a program. It's not like I could just leave the studio and go buy you chocolate peanut butter bugles.
I could have played a song also, and read a long story or
also,
something.
Also, you damn woman. You know what? Here's the other thing. Is that you turned down Cobbler this morning because you just met a weight goal, and then like five times you've mentioned that I didn't bring you chocolate peanut butter bugles, which if I'd given them to you would just have resulted in like self-loathing and then anger directed at me for contributing to said self-loathing by giving you the chocolate and peanut butter bugles, which you clearly don't want but continue to ask for.
I'm complicated. That's part of what makes me so lovable.
Yes. Is that what they call that? Is this some new definition of lovable of which I was not previously aware?
That's why I'm intriguing.
Anywho, the Institute of Inspection, Cleaning, Restoration, Certification, basically, it's some governing star chamber-like body that signs off on...
Now read it again. It's the what?
Institute of Inspection and Cleaning Restoration Certification.
Okay.
So basically, they say that you're qualified to go to some guy's house and, I don't know, power suck his carpet, basically.
You know, I used to have a certification kind of like that.
Bada bing! I'm so sorry about all this. Michael Beatty, he's paying for this. Inexplicably.
He's a deeply patient man.
Really? Easy to please, apparently. Really, right there, that ought to be, in and of itself, that ought to be justification. That ought to be all the motivation you need for contacting Michael Beatty. The fact that he continues to pay us and to be one of our many paying clients after we just mangle his copy in every conceivable way, and in many ways that are probably not conceivable by most people. Well, whatever. Locally owned and operated, supporting local businesses. He, in fact, buys all of his products from local businesses, and he keeps his advertising, for today anyway, his advertising dollars here on the Rick Emerson Show, and we are glad to have him. They do stain removal, carpet repairs, upholstery, stone, marble tile. They get rid of odors, and if you've got pets maybe that have made a mess of the place somehow, they've soiled the carpet in some fashion, take care of that. Residential and commercial work and regular maintenance program as well, and of course, the Institute of Inspection, Cleaning, Restoration, and Certification says that he's a fine guy who provides a great service at a fair price. The cleaning solution, Michael Beatty, 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program on the Emerson News Network. What's up with the phrase, balls to the wall?
From the Emerson News Network, this is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Rick Emerson. Pedal to the metal, eastbound and down. The number of ways in which we describe doing something at full effort or speed is fairly staggering and occasionally confusing, especially when these expressions seem to make little or no sense. For example, what does the phrase balls to the wall actually mean? As with most exotic nomenclature, there's a military history to this phrase, specifically the world of aviation. Two controls found in most military airplanes are the throttle and the joystick, one controlling the craft's power, the other its orientation, to send the plane into a dive, for example. These controls are often topped with a roundish, ball-shaped grip. So, that handles the ball part of the expression. What about the wall? Well, directly in front of the cockpit is a combination empty space and solid construction, which is designed to prevent an engine fire from reaching the rest of the plane. This is called the firewall. So, if one were piloting such an airplane and were to push the plane's velocity and angle to the extreme, going all out, this would require moving both the throttle, using its ball-like handle, all the way forward toward the firewall, and the joystick as well, putting both balls to or toward the wall. One historian notes that the expression is first found in military aviation sources that date from the Vietnam War, and it was recorded in the slang of U.S. Air Force Academy cadets in 1969. Although no evidence from the period has come to light, Korean War veterans have also reliably claimed to have used balls to the wall in the 1950s. And now, you're just a little bit smarter than you were moments ago.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. All right, we have some news to get through here in a few. You know, I didn't even mention this Mormon luau I got invited to. Hold on a second. It's a phrase you don't hear all that often.
No.
We'll get to the news here in a second. So I got to say, I came home and I found this. Here's the thing is that they must know somehow. By they, I mean Mormons. I don't think it's that like everybody in our neighborhood or our ward has been invited to these Mormon things. I think that they must know that my wife was a Mormon, and I'm suspecting they know that because of her parents. They've like tipped off. You know, making it sound way more conspiratorial than I think it is. It's just that the Mormons keep tabs on everybody. I mean, and I don't mean that in some sort of nefarious way, but it's like because of the whole genealogy thing and record keeping. They just know where everybody is. Like if you ever have like a missing person or somebody like you need to track down, you just ask the Mormon church and they'll find whoever it is, whether they want to be. They had to put the Mormon church in charge of finding D.B. Cooper. You just track that guy down by tomorrow. So because my wife grew up Mormon, her parents are still incredibly, you know, religious and they're LDS, you know, they're Latter-day Saints or whatever. So I think that her parents must have, like, told their local guy who told the guy here who, you know, which is why we get missionaries coming by our house, I would say probably once a month. Most places, you tell the missionaries to piss off, and it's like they stay pissed off. Here, we say, like, you know, we don't, you know, we're all full up. Move on. And they just come back, like, 2 or 3 weeks later. And, you know, they're always so polite, and it just, I can't bring myself to be rude to them. And, you know, anyway, so they just continue to return, you know, like mosquitoes. So I came home the other day, and there's this thing on the front of my door. It's like a little, you know, it's like a little flyer or something. It's like the size of one of those things that like you'd find on your windshield wiper where it's like a chick tract or something. It's something telling you about the miraculous plan that Jesus has for your life. Except in the front is this sort of like bad, like tiki clip art. And it says, Luau Party. And then it's flanked by these sort of demonic looking, you know, like tiki heads. And on the back it says, I should ask Cheryl about this because Cheryl, like everybody else I know in my life, is from goddamn Hawaii for some reason. It's just everybody I know. I'm just surrounded by Hawaiians like at every turn. You know, Cheryl, Hawaii. Tim Oakley, Hawaii. Colin Ivey, the guy who's the film and producer at Outlook Portland, Hawaii. Lisa Desjardins, Hawaii. Everywhere I go. The Church of Jesus Christ, it says on the back, of Latter-day Saints, Milwaukee, Oregon, Steak Luau. That doesn't make any sense, but
they came all the way from Milwaukee to Southeast Portland
I guess,
invite you to a luau.
I guess the steak, or the you know the sort of which is like a parish if you're Catholic, mm-hmm. Is in Milwaukee, but it's the Milwaukee, Oregon steak luau, which is called Aloha Ohanas, and I have no idea what that means. Saturday, August 21st, blah, 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 at the chapel, whatever. Everyone is invited to take part in, all caps, authentic island food and entertainment. And then it says the most intriguing thing. And this is, again, keep in mind, this is a Mormon luau to which I have been invited. Get there early to see the Kahlua pig removed from the pit at 5 p.m. So I know that Kahlua is not just a booze. It must be some sort of other thing. Dawn, do you know what a Kahlua pig is?
I do indeed.
What is it?
An entire cooked pig in a pit. And it's Kahlua in this case is spelled differently than the coffee liqueur. No, it's a traditional Hawaiian
Do you know
food.
What Kahlua means, though? I mean, in other words, I know what they're signifying.
I don't know what the word specifically means, but it is essentially a pit-roasted whole pig.
So it's when they do the whole pig with okay. See, I might almost... That's actually tempting. We should go, actually.
You should go.
So it's tomorrow. I should actually see. You know, my wife's always saying I never take her anywhere.
Yeah.
I should. But here's
she speaks the lingo.
That's the thing is she totally, she can communicate with it. And the thing is, and I know this sounds weird. I could pass for Mormon because I don't have any facial hair.
Until they figure out that you shouldn't actually be there and they all turn like children of the corn and point at you.
No, see, here's the thing is they would totally, they would embrace me there because I am an empty vessel, which they can fill.
I know. I joke about the Mormon, but they're actually lovely people.
No, they're and good dancers, all of them. They have rhythm. So it says here, Kahlua pig, blah, 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 blah. Show your, quotes, aloha spirit, end quote, by wearing your island clothes. I should know for the record, I have no island clothes as such. Games for the kids and families, a limbo contest. Wonderful musical guests. I instinctively disbelieve that statement. And much more, 2 exclamation marks. And at the bottom, there's some Hawaiian speak. It says, Ohanas Mau Loa, or whatever. So I just brought this as sort of a wacky gag, but now I'm thinking I might want to go. See, because, and then here's the two. This is like five birds, one stone. It's show prep for Monday. Mm-hmm. It's dinner, because all I got to bring is, apparently all I have to bring are plates and utensils.
So there's your two birds.
So my dinner, it gets my wife off my back for never having taken her. And you don't take me anywhere. We never go out. All we do is we sit at home and we shoot zombies on the Xbox. Whatever. So that's three. Mm-hmm. The fourth is that it gives, I'm a genius. It gives her something to talk to her parents about.
Yes.
Because, you know, she has to do, like many people who inexplicably remain in contact with her family, she talks to them once a week on Sunday, the Lord's Day. She calls her parents, and she talks to her dad about the stock market. She talks to her mom about how Obama's a Muslim. Her mom talks about that. Lara listens and tries not to scream. And then she passes the phone to me. I make incredibly awkward small talk. And then I hand the phone back, and then we hang up. Also, you know what? She's going to Vegas next week to speak at a convention for her business, and then but then after that she's going to Utah, so she'll have something to talk to her parents about during the long awkward stretches of time in Utah when her mom is just sitting there half-lifing into the sofa watching Judge Judy.
This is just a huge win in every way.
There is no way that's
free pork,
and I'm sure that there's a fifth bird with the stone. I just don't know what it is right now. But that's I don't own island clothes though.
I bet you know somebody who could loan you a Hawaiian shirt, though.
That's the fifth stone right there, is to get the photograph of me and Lara wearing, like, our suburban white guy, like, luau shirts and doing, like, a thumbs up. And you know that they're going to have, like, big, tacky, plastic tiki glasses filled with some horrible, like, Trader Vic's-type beverage.
I'm seeing a Christmas card photo right here.
I'm totally going to this. We're completely going. And it's in Milwaukee.
Well, while you are at that, I will be tomorrow at Bacon Fest.
Yes.
PDX-FM hosting Bacon Fest, second annual Bacon Fest, 1800 block of East Burnside. Everybody should go. So $5 get in, 2 cans of food for the food bank. The Bacon Vodka people will be there. There'll be food carts with bacon-related foods. There's a bacon dance contest.
I don't understand.
I had to ask about that myself. Apparently, it's a dance contest where people dance while eating bacon, and then the audience cheers them on and votes for, like, who they like doing the bacon dance the
best.
Here's
the thing about that is that if, you know, like Pompeii style, if Mount St. Helens were to erupt again and just cover this entire joint with lava, and they're going to dig us out in 5,000 years, they're going to think that bacon was some sort of a god we worshipped. And it is, by the way. Let's have no illusions about that. This fetishization of bacon is—it's not that I object to it. It's just interesting. It's just—it's a strange development we've had in our culture. Hey, did I mention?
I did want to mention. I'm sorry, don't interrupt. No. But I keep forgetting to mention this. Another great thing about Bacon Fest: 21 and over.
Oh, there you go. So no children.
No children. There will not. It's an actual street festival in Portland where there will be no children. And there will be bacon and booze.
You've just reminded me of the one big downside to going to this Mormon luau.
Oh, there will be children.
Children aplenty.
And no booze.
And you know, and here's the other thing. You know what'll be awkward? Is that they're going to ask us why we don't have kids. And then I'm going to have to say that she's barren.
Why don't you just lie and say, they're at camp.
Oh, that, hey, there you go. Look at you, player. All right, well done. All right. No, that's totally what I'm going to be. No. Better than that, better than at camp, because, you know, because Mormons, I will
Bible
say.
Bible camp. Mm, nope.
Well, they don't. I don't think they really do Bible camp. Yeah, maybe they do. I don't know. No. I'll say they're with their grandparents.
Yeah.
Because it's Mormons love family togetherness. They are all about the family core. And
they're
in
Utah with their grandparents.
That in Provo. They are in Provo, the home of BYU, with their grandparents. And I'm not trying to be snarky. Mormons are very, very family oriented. And so this makes everybody happy. Awesome. Fantastic. Well done. Excellent.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Horrified UK residents claim their homes are being invaded by giant rats, including a 30-inch long monster that was shot dead by a homeowner. The rodents, twice the size of common rats, are plaguing an estate in West Yorks in the northern United Kingdom, often appearing in kitchens and living rooms. Some fear they could be super rats from South America. But the shaken man who shot one dead, 31-year-old Brandon Goddard, yesterday revealed four others of the same size scuttled away to safety. They were more like Ratzillas than rats, Goddard said. I got out of there as fast as I could. Who knows how many more there will be if they've been breeding. The shot rat, feared to be from a species native to South America, is twice as big as common British types and the largest seen in the UK. The residents of Ravenscliff Estate, where the rat was found, are used to seeing massive rodents that sometimes appear in their kitchens and lounges.
Is there a photo?
There is indeed. The new colony shocked the residents, however. Shown a picture of the dead rat, mother of five, Rebecca Holmes, gasped, "Oh my God, I've seen them as big as cats, but never that big." Brandon toted an air rifle as he went ratting with pals on the edge of the estate, which they heard was right with rodents.
He went ratting.
The group heard rustling and scrabbling before the five huge rats shot out from behind a wall. Brandon, a manager at a cleaning firm, said, "The first went right past, but we got the second one, then three more got away. I've seen thousands of rats during the course of my work and go shooting a couple of times a week, but I've never seen any as big as this. The one I shot was absolutely terrifying."
All right, let me just see if there's a shades of gravy. Jesus, God. I wonder if this is like a forced perspective
thing. That's the size of a medium-sized dog.
This is larger. This is larger than Max, my dog. Jesus, God. I don't understand. I have never before so wanted a story to be a hoax. Here's the best thing about it, by the way, because it is the Sun. Ginormous rats is in the headline. Ginormous rats invade UK housing complex. Christ. All right, no, I'm going to put that face down. By the way, earlier you heard our stupid criminal of the week, which is brought to you by MugsHotList.com, alias MugshotList.com, a fine listener named Andy runs that. And so stupid criminal of the week, of course, as you might have guessed, does happen, in fact, every week. And as part of that, we're giving away a free full-service membership to MugshotList.com. Oh. This week, that goes to Jeff Henderson. Mr. Jeff Henderson, you are the winner of one membership to MugshotList.com, brought to you by my friend and proprietor, Andy, who runs that outfit. So there you go, MugshotList.com, going to Jeff Henderson. Next Friday, we will have another giveaway and another shot at that with another installment of Stupid Criminal of the Week. Here is Dawn Taylor. By the way, did I mention I've got sound from the movie Piranha? The 3D Piranha
thing. Oh, no, you didn't.
I don't know anything about the movie except kind of what I've seen on Ain't It Cool, which is where it's a remake of the Joe Dante Piranha from 1976, I believe, or 8.
Which the original was written by John Sayles.
You mentioned that, and I didn't know that. I haven't seen the original Piranha in maybe 2 or 3 years, but I love that movie.
It's really good.
I am a huge fan of the movie Piranha.
And I say that unironically.
Oh,
as horror films of that period go, it's one of the best.
It really is good. And, and Joe Dante's not a bad filmmaker by any stretch of the imagination.
Director of Matinee.
Yes. Wait, really?
Yeah.
I thought you were about to reference Oh, fail. I was just about
You directed Gremlins.
That's what I was going to say. Because here's the thing. In my brain, I wanted to say Goonies, but that's Richard Donner.
And the guy who wrote Matinee, by the way, Charles S. Huss, he actually wrote Gremlins 2, The New Batch.
I love Gremlins 2, The New Batch. Have you seen Gremlins 2, The New Batch? Oh, it's awesome. I saw on Homicide, I was watching Homicide Life in the Street, a rerun the other day, and one of the guys on Homicide was the guy who played Clamp, the Donald Trump character in Gremlins 2.
Oh, wow.
I love him. Gremlins 2, if anybody has not seen Gremlins 2, you are missing out. It is so much better than the first Gremlins. You really, and I mean that, and I'm not talking about like it's so bad, it's good. It's legitimately great. I saw it in the theater, and then I saw it on VHS. It really is exceptionally well done. It's like halfway through the filming, they must have just went, this will never work as a straight-ahead sequel. Let's parody ourselves. F it.
So you had sound for two Joe Dante movies. The new Piranha movie is not a Joe Dante movie, but you referenced Joe Dante at the beginning of the show without even realizing.
Yeah, I didn't know. So I was going to say he directed Goonies, but there's Richard Donner, but he directed Gremlins. So Joe Dante made Piranha starring Heather Menzies, Bradford Dillman, Kevin McCarthy, and Paul Bartel of Eating Raoul fame. And Piranha is really good. It's got what's her name? The Scream Queen, Barbara Steele, I believe, is in that film. Piranha, if you have not seen the original Piranha, first of all, I encourage you to do so. It's really good. And I haven't seen it in a couple of years, and maybe it's, it might have dated a little bit, just in the last couple of years. But it's still, for a B-horror film, it's great. This new Piranha is basically just seems to be like a remake of the old one, except it's in 3D, now.
All I know about it is it's based on the first one, it's in 3D, and apparently Jerry O'Connell plays a porn actor and he gets his penis ripped off by a piranha. That's all I know about this whole movie.
And doesn't it have, it has a big guest, it's like Ving Rhames in it or somebody, Richard Dreyfuss is in it. Richard Dreyfuss is in it. I was reading an Ain't It Cool review last night, and I had to actually go back and read it again to make sure that it wasn't mistaken somehow. I don't know if it's a cameo or if it's like a full thing or if he's doing like a send up of the
what
Hooper
else does
character.
He have to do?
Mr. Holland's Opus 2. Richard Dreyfuss is in it, a whole bunch of people, but I guess it's got the same. I guess it's got the same plot and everything. Do you remember the tagline for the original Piranha?
Mm-mm.
Lost River Rake. Lost River Rake. Lost River Lake was a thriving resort until they discovered ellipsis. Piranha! Or Piranha, as Kevin McCarthy says in that film. Kevin McCarthy, I can do astonishing amounts of dialogue from the original Piranha. Where Bradford Dillman puts his hand on it and he goes, well, Piranha are freshwater fish. They can't live here. And then Kevin McCarthy says, it was the military. We were designing a special kind of piranha to swim up the river systems of the Viet Cong. Operation Razor Teeth. And then you get to see Heather Menzies' breasts. And she, by the way, was Liesel in Sound of Music. So if you ever watched the Von Trapp girls and you said, I wonder what they looked like all grown up and nude, seek help. B, you get to see the up top part of Heather Menzies in Piranha, where she distracts a guard, I swear to God, by saying, look up there, it's Superman, and then ripping open her shirt. It's just as good as I'm making it sound. So I got, there's no story to go with this really, but I got some sound, and I should tell you, I don't know what the sound is at all. I have not previewed it. This is sound from the new 3D Piranha film that came out today. It could just be the sound of like fish going like, bah, 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 bah. I don't know. So we're just going to play it and see what it is. I have no idea what this sound is.
Sam?
Something bit me.
Sam, what are you seeing down there?
Oh my God.
That's it.
Oh.
Let's one more time.
Sam?
Something bit me.
Sam, what are you seeing down there?
Oh my God.
Yeah. Do you remember how they killed the piranha at the end of the original?
No, I don't remember.
It's great. It's a movie you could never make now. You could never have the original Piranha. I could talk about the original Piranha forever. You could never have that movie released now because they kill the piranha because there's an abandoned and now underwater smelting plant down the way.
Oh, God, that's
and
right.
And Bradford Dillman ties a rope around himself. He swims out of water to like the release valve or whatever, like the waste valve that is now sealed up for the underwater smelting plant. And he just releases thousands of gallons of toxic smelting waste into a river to kill the piranha and presumably everything else. You know, and so that he does it by polluting the river with toxic industrial chemicals. But then, of course, the movie ends with the allusion that, you know, alluding to the piranha or piranha having gotten into the ocean and presumably the industrial waste following them as well, which I believe is what mutates them into, wait for it, flying piranha in the second film directed by James Cameron, Piranha 2, The Spawning, which is James Cameron's first movie. So there you go. And that's true. Also, I can't even believe I didn't tell you this. Do you know what I have now at home? I have – you don't even care, do you?
I do. I do care.
This is one of those things where
I don't – I never know how to respond when somebody says, do you know what I have at home? And I always say something like, Richard Burton's spleen. I don't know.
You just did – actually, here's what you did when I just said, do you know what I have at home? And you went, mm-mm. Here's what it was. It was that tone of voice that indicates that, like, in your head you're going, he's clearly on to some sort of a roll here, so I'm just going to let him tire himself out, and then we'll get on with the news, and I can go home. I just got this the other day, a three-pack, not a one, not a two, a three-pack of bad 3D horror films from the 80s in 3D. So now all I need to do is find the glasses somewhere. And I don't know where you can get those at like 7-Eleven or whatever to get some crap to tie in with some other crap movie that's coming out. So if I can...
The little blue and red one on each side?
And there's a name for that, and I forget what it's called, that kind of 3D. If I can find myself the 3D glasses, a few pair, I was telling them, I'm like...
How did the pack of movies not come with a little cardboard 3D glasses? Oh, you didn't buy it new, is what you're saying.
Yes, they were...
You didn't buy it in a pack, like in a box.
Used.
Yeah.
Used by, they. Yes, they were
gotcha.
Used.
Gotcha.
And anyway, but I told Laura, I'm like, if we can get some glasses, we can have a full-on, like, 3D horror movie viewing party in our living room, and the movie will actually be in 3D. So, Steve, can you guess, and they're all from the 80s, can you guess what the three 3D horror films are?
No. You tell me.
I'll give you a hint.
Okay.
It's not Piranha, but I'll give you a hint on one of them.
Sam?
Something bit me!
Was Alligator in 3D?
No, but good reference. No.
Jaws 3D?
Jaws 3D.
No. What else?
Let's see if I have clues for the other two. Let's see. Oh, wait. You know, I just did like, you know what I just did there? I just did like a whole, ooh, Yanni kind of a sound. Let's see if I can, I have it right here, actually. This is how lame I am. I actually have the soundtrack to one of these films. Okay. Let's see if we got here. All right. And it's the disco. It was too late to actually... It was so far past the disco era, you wouldn't think this would exist. But the third movie in this series actually had a disco theme.
So is this one of, like, the big horror movies? Like Friday the 13th? Or Halloween 3 in 3D? Was Halloween 3 in 3D?
No.
There's...
Do you have a final answer, Don Taylor?
I do not have a final answer.
It is, in fact, Friday the 13th, 3D.
I said that.
I was waiting to see if that was your...
Well...
This is from the...
I got no response from you, so I figured I must be wrong.
This is from the Friday the 13th 3 soundtrack.
Yeah.
In which they've taken the typical Friday, the regular Friday the 13th score, and they've put it to this sort of... Wow, 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 sort of bed. I have this on vinyl, by the way.
Wow.
So I've got Jaws 3D. I've got Friday the 13th 3D.
Now, is that the Friday the 13th that Crispin Glover was in?
No, he's in part 4.
Oh.
He's in part 4, the final Friday, I think they call it.
Which it wasn't.
No. Is that the final Friday? I think it must. I think it's the one that's called the final Friday.
I can't tell any of them apart.
That's the one.
Crispin
Glover and Corey Feldman are both in that one. Crispin Glover, who dies, by the way, when he gets a corkscrew put through his hand and then a television over his head. So Friday the 13th 3D, I got Jaws 3D, and then I got Amityville 3D.
Oh, dear God.
Which is terrible. Terrible. I know that's a big shock to you. It is awful. Yeah.
Well, the first movie in that series, I mean, was not
good.
Also the
bad.
Original Amityville horror was not good.
So. Nothing associated with the word Amityville has ever been good. Here's Don Taylor at the news desk.
Ricky Martin has picked an appropriate title for his autobiography.
I'm gay.
Me.
Oh, all right.
The Puerto Rican singer is set to release his memoir on November 2nd. It will also be released in Spanish the same day. That edition will be titled Yo, which is Spanish for I and me. Martin has said that preparing to write the book was one of the reasons he decided to reveal earlier that he is as gay as a tangerine.
I bet Ricky Martin gets laid like nobody's been. I bet he gets laid more than anyone has ever gotten laid on Earth.
Well, he is a handsome, handsome, handsome man.
Yeah, he's a beautiful man. He really is.
He really is. Martin said in a statement Thursday that the project led him to extract memories that he had erased from his mind.
Wait, molestation.
He doesn't say.
Oh.
He says the movie was the book was not easy, but allowed for an incredible spiritual journey.
All right, whatever.
So there you go.
All right. Do we have a watch still to do somewhere?
No,
we have to do it.
Oh yeah, I have a job watch.
We can wait, and we can do it today, or we can do it Monday. It doesn't matter. I'm just making sure we get everything we're supposed to get.
Through. It's not that much fun. Let's leave it till Monday.
Put it off. All right.
Not that anything that I really have left.
Nothing is as fun as.
Sam, something bit me.
Well, in the spirit of that, I will read this. A surfer has died after his leg was torn to shreds by a shark in front of horrified beachgoers.
Sam,
something bit me.
Dad of two, Nicholas Edwards, 31, had been riding waves off the coast of Australia when he was mauled by the shark, thought to be a great white. He was pulled from the bloody water by fellow surfers who battled for 20 minutes to keep him alive.
Damn.
Nicholas eventually died on the way to the hospital this morning. Or actually, I think this was yesterday morning. Local surfer Eddie Kilgallen, 42, was about 200 meters away from the attack at South Point in Western Australia when he heard shouting and a man yelling, "Shark! Shark!" There were about four of us in the water, and we all freaked out, he said. We started paddling for shore, and a pod of seals came up in the middle of us. I thought it was a shark at first and thought, that's it, I'm gone too. Nicholas, who's a miner from Busselton, south of Perth, was dragged out of the ocean onto the beach. Eddie added, we wrapped a sweater around his legs and used a leg rope as a tourniquet. I was holding what was left of his leg together. The bottom half of his thigh was exposed and ripped open. Half his calf muscle was also torn to shreds. I saw he had a wedding ring and was telling him that his wife wanted to see him again. Another eyewitness, Rob Alder, said he had been checking the surf from his balcony when he noticed a board that had been bitten in half floating without a rider. Then he saw Nicholas covered in blood with his leg shredded. There's the bitten in half.
Creepy. And it's just what it sounds like. I mean, it's just a surfboard. It's just the front half of it. And there's the big jagged. I mean, sharks are really just, and I mean this in the dictionary sense, they're just awesome. I mean, they are just have you seen that photo? And I saw a little article about it on the Intertron where they were doing the backstory of the photo. And so it turns out the photo is legitimate because it looks like a thing that almost had to be Photoshopped, but it turns out it's real. It is a photo of a guy in like a little skiff. He's like in a little kayak, and he is sort of paddling in from the open water to the shore, and it's a photo taken from above up in the air, and there is like a huge, like a 25-foot shark just trailing him in the kayak. Have you seen the photo?
No.
I'll find it before the end of the show here. I'll find it here in a second. I'll show it to you because you got to see it. It's taken from like a helicopter, and it's him just sort of just kayaking in towards shore, not looking behind him, which is good, and then in the water behind him, you just see this huge, unmistakable shadow of a massive shark just following him, just thinking maybe he'll fall out. So, yeah.
It's summertime, and so we see more and more like shark attacks and people having near misses with sharks, particularly in Florida. And one of my favorite writers in the whole world, Carl Hyacin, who works as a columnist in Florida as well as writing novels. He has gone there. He wrote a wonderful essay that I believe was published in the newspaper that he writes for a couple of years ago, basically just saying, what do you people expect?
Right.
You know, we have these boats that go out full of tourists and we dump hundreds of gallons of chum in the water to attract the sharks so the tourists can look at them.
Right, right.
And then you're surprised when people get attacked by sharks. They're sharks. They go, hey, food. They're not distinguishing between the buckets of food you're dumping in and the food that is paddling around on a surfboard.
No, it's what they do. I mean, it is their deal. Well, you know, and that's a friend of mine had that whole thing where he was out on a boat or something, and you know, nothing ever happened, but it was, you know, he saw a shark kind of. He was out, I don't know if he was fishing, if he was just out pleasure boating or whatever, but he saw a shark, kind of a fin or whatever, and then it broke the water, and I think it was actually in the process of, like, eating something else, and then it just flipped and vanished. And he said that was the only time he'd ever seen it. But he said he realized at that moment, he's like, what we have said before, which is like, oh, wait a minute. This is where they live. And also, not only are they predators, but we are just sort of de facto training them to attack things, again, by using chum and baiting and whatever. There's that thing, that quote that I've said a million times, where there's that lifeguard who worked one of those bell tower things in Florida, you know, where they like are shark towers where they on the lookout. And he just said, and then I'll show you this photograph. He said if people knew what routinely swam within 10 or 15 feet of them, they would never go in the water again.
The shark thing, the chum baiting thing in Florida, it's just like the town of Amity in Jaws. It's like every couple of years, people do try to pass some kind of legislation where they say, stop dumping chum in the water to attract sharks. And all of the tourist commissions and the people who operate the tour boats and stuff rise up as one and say, no, you'll destroy our livelihood. We depend on being able to, like, take tourists out in boats and show them sharks.
Yeah.
They go, well, okay, then stop complaining that people are getting eaten.
Yeah, so then you get what you get, friend. All right, I have just posted this on Facebook, by the way. It is visual aid number one for Friday's Rick Emerson show. You look at that. You can go look at it. You won't really experience, like, the full horror until you click on it. That is visual aid number one for Friday's Rick Emerson show. It is
oh my god!
That's what I'm saying, and that's real, by the way. That is real. That is that. And
I like the guy is like looking over his shoulder, like yikes!
Just a little bit, like wait, did I hear a noise? Ah, crap! I saw a little article about this, and that's, I mean, you know, and they say 3.8 meters, which is, I don't know, maybe 15 feet or something. But people say, well, it's only 15 feet. I don't really think it matters at that point.
Well, yeah, the shark can close that space in about 5 seconds.
Yeah, yeah.
If it so chooses.
Yeah, the mouth just has to be bigger than the smallest part of you.
Yeah.
Jesus. All right. Well, let's do like one more here, and then we'll bring an end to this whole carnival of merriment.
Several Indiana lawmakers are working on legislation that would ban the use and sale of the synthetic marijuana known as K2 or spice. The illegal herbal incense used to get high gained the attention of local and state legislators when several communities began discussing and introducing bans on their own. Representative John Barnes of Indianapolis has publicly announced he will file a bill to ban the substance in January, but he also worries about bringing it to the attention of teenagers. There's so much publicity right now that there are an awful lot of kids and adults who are thinking, okay, well, if this stuff gets banned, we won't have a chance to try it.
That's exactly what I was just thinking when you started this article.
Lawmakers have been busy talking with neighborhood leaders about the harmful effects of the substance
K2?
For some time.
K2? Is it spelled like K and 2?
Yeah.
All right.
And proposing a statewide ban is the logical next step. Young folks, and really anyone, who are using the substance, being under the influence and driving around dangerously, doing harm to others, said Representative Phil Giaquinta of Fort Wayne, it's obviously becoming a concern not only in our community but around the whole state.
So this is like that, what is it, sativa or salvia or something? There
was
something.
That's what I was trying to remember what the word, it was like.
Salvia,
something like that, yeah.
Or it was like some weed. That they were selling, some shrub thing. And they said it was like peyote, or it was like, you know, whatever. It was like Jimson weed almost.
Because there's some smoke shop or whatever on Barber that I drive by sometimes, and it has these big signs with something like that. We sell, and it's some word
I think it's Salvia.
I'd never heard of before. And I kept thinking, I should go on the internet and look that up. Then I never bothered
I
to.
Did, actually,
I did, actually.
But here's the – well, see, and the stuff like that fascinates me. I am fascinated, as you know, by many illicit aspects of our culture, including – like I like the whole constant battle to make things illegal as they are discovered or created, like designer drugs, how they'll make something that's just different enough that it's not illegal. Apparently there's this thing – and they always have the worst names. There's this thing in Europe. It's called – I swear to Christ, it's called Meow Meow, they call it. And it's just – and so you have these great stories where these parents are like blubbering over their idiot kids who overdosed. He overdosed at Meow Meow. And, you know, it's like that's an unmanly way to go out.
Yeah.
There's the greatest drug, by the way. I don't know anything about it. I just know the name of it. It was some sort of a sedative and a speed all at once, which sounds fantastic. And it was called Methadrone. And just based on the name alone, Methadrone, it either sounds like a great sort of black metal band or it sounds like a drug that I really want to try. But that Salvia thing. I went online, I was looking it up, and it became really irritating because you know what it was? It was like reading some message board about absinthe where you realize it's a bunch of idiots who don't know what they're talking about all of them accusing the other guys of being idiots who don't know what they're talking about. And each post claiming that they knew the definitive answer about absinthe, or in this case, the salvia. One guy saying, I tried it and it was like, it messed me up for days and it was worse than mescaline. And another guy saying, like, I tried it and it just makes you cough and it doesn't do anything at all. And no one could agree on what it did or didn't do. So which means it indicates to me that it probably isn't a real drug, because a real drug will at least affect everybody, if not in the same way. So
I had one of those weird breakthroughs of opinion where I just realized that I feel that I've just sometimes you just hit a wall with something in your own mind where you're just so tired of hearing about something that you just go, ah, crap. And I had that the other day where I'm a very liberal person when it comes to like social issues and, you know, helping people out and helping the unfortunate and the needy. But I'm also kind of libertarian when it comes to like laws that stop people from just doing stuff that
right.
only harms themselves.
Right.
And so, you know, as far as like drug legislation, I just find it all really annoying and stupid anyway. But I was listening to like, I think it was NPR just the other day, and I'm driving home and I'm already tired and cranky anyway. And there's a bunch of
Why would
stuff
that be?
About cigarettes and about cigarette taxes and how much cigarette taxes are and how it means that a pack of cigarettes now in Oregon is like $6 or something, and it's going to go up even further because they're adding more cigarette taxes. And then they were talking about how the cigarette taxes were good because the money from the cigarette taxes goes to all of these programs to tell people to stop smoking the cigarettes that they're buying, that the money's going for the programs to tell them to not do it. And I was so damn tired of hearing about this. Honest to God, I just finally hit that point where I just thought, why don't you just make it illegal already then?
Well, that's what I've said for the longest time.
If the government really honestly believes that tobacco is such a damn health hazard, why don't you just say, screw you, tobacco companies, screw you, R.J. Reynolds, and just make it freaking illegal?
Yeah, well, that's what – and I've made that claim for the longest time. That, I mean, if the government – if they are really going to say that it is not only harmful to the user, which I don't care about because that's a victimless crime, but if they really believe, which – I also tend to believe that it is harmful on some level to those who are to passive recipients of the smoke. And I know that there are conflicting studies on that. I'm just saying for me, it seems logical to say that secondhand smoke is at least somewhat dangerous. But if the government's going to make that claim that it'll kill you, then there's no reason on earth why they still ought to sell it. They ought to just remove it and be done with it.
Because the way our government handles it right now is just so ridiculous. You know, we're going to keep telling you over and over and over again that it's incredibly dangerous and it kills you and that we hate it. But we're not going to stop you from doing it. We're just going to keep taxing you.
Yeah, we'll keep taking money for it.
And then keep letting people form organizations to try and stop you from doing this thing that we think is
horrible. No, I'm with you on that. No, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Either just lay off and let people kill themselves and get lung cancer, or make it illegal.
Yeah.
One of the two.
Well, that was my thing with prostitution too, where it's where the government even within states, the different counties can't agree on whether or not it solves certain problems or increases other problems. And so instead they just continue to do this whole thing, well, you shouldn't do it, but if you're gonna, we want the money from it. And so we want to tax it and regulate it, and we want to make the money from this thing that we are constantly telling you shouldn't do. So no, you and I are on the same page there. I'm not an uppercase L libertarian. I'm not a capital L libertarian because they're crazy. But I am very much a colloquial libertarian in the sense that I'm, you know, sort of a Harry Blackmun, the Supreme Court justice, and he said one of the defining traits of the American freedom is the right to be left alone. And that's kind of my thing. Rush Limbaugh said this great thing one time where he said he was talking about. He's talking about the government and government intrusion. And he said, I would prefer the government did not even know I existed in most cases. And that's me as well. You know what? Print money, secure borders, fight wars, whatever you're going to do. You know, the rest of the time, you just leave me alone, especially if I'm in my house. Unless I'm flogging someone who doesn't want to be flogged, then. You just get off my back. Just let me do whatever it is I want to do. And that's really the way the government ought to behave. So you and I are on the same page there, Don Taylor. All right. With that, should we – anything else you want to say? What else – oh, wait. I'm stalling a little bit here because I got to get this piece of closing copy ready and get the we'll end the show. We'll have a little musical interlude, as is our wont, and then we will have an encore of today's Legion of News, and then an encore of this program, which will then loop throughout the weekend. Coming up next week, guests will include Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week.
I think we're both looking at the board where nothing for next week is actually written on it.
Ryan White will be here on Monday, and then in, I think, 2 weeks, Peter Carlin and Anna Griffin both start becoming sort of a regular guest for us. So
I have a crush on Peter Carlin. I realized that
you
yesterday.
Hide it really well, by the way.
It happened about halfway through him being here yesterday. Suddenly
talking about the sex club.
Suddenly, I don't know what it was. It was just he's so strange and he's so perverse and odd and wonderful. And there was this point where I just felt like the Grinch, like my tiny cold black little heart just swelled up three sizes.
Well, it's that. Here's the thing about Peter is that. Well, you and I were talking about this a bit before the show. The thing with Ryan White, who I saw out a couple nights ago just having a beer down the street, and I know it always just sounds like I've got some weird man crush on Ryan White. It's just that he is it's not really the case. He's not my type at all. It's just that I always like guys who've got the – you know, I envy guys, I guess, who've got the effortless cool thing going on. And – but at the same time, he's just so relentlessly clean cut, and you get the feeling that it's like – the real deal, too. You get the feeling that he is not like one of those like charming guys who's like secretly a bad boy. I'm not saying he's boring in any way, but I'm saying I don't get the sense that he's like secretly, like he has like an inner dirtbag somehow. I get the feeling he is that guy. He's sort of charming and nice and polite. And
he's one of those guys that seems flosses. To just really know himself really well. He's really comfortable with himself. He just throws on clothes and they look good. His hair's he could probably use a little bit of a haircut, but even needing a haircut looks good on him. It's almost hateful how just
he seems like
cool
a guy
and delightful he is.
That in some alternate world, he seems like a guy in an alternate world ought to have a drinking problem and a drug habit and be in some sort of Wilco type band. But in this world, he's just sort of like, he's just this sort of guy. Whereas with Peter Carlin, Peter Carlin, also an attractive man, dresses well.
Married, a father,
Here's the thing about Peter Carlin. I don't know that this is true. When he's here next time, here's the thing. You and I have to make a pact. When he's here next time, we have to try to find this out somehow. I believe that Peter Carlin, over the last year and a half at some point, I believe he either formally or informally got a stylist. Because if you think about thinking about the way Peter Carlin looked and dressed a couple years ago, and now the last five or six times I've seen him, he's dressed very well. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I mean, I don't make a big secret of the fact that I had a series of sort of makeovers with basically just Sarah and a bunch of gay guys just sort of pinning me down and saying, stop wearing this. I was actually thinking about this watch, which I am wearing today. Which is, very simple and basic and whatever. But this is actually the first item. This is actually the first thing we did this whole ongoing bit in the show, long before Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, by the way, I have to say, where these gay guys took me shopping and they had me like start getting better clothing and better whatever. And this watch is actually the first thing that I picked out for myself that they approved.
Oh.
And they said something really simple but really obvious. They said a watch isn't a timepiece. A watch is jewelry. And I never really thought about that because I was a tool. So over the course of the last few years, some people have helped me figure out kind of a way to look presentable, and I sort of do that now. I think Peter Carlin has somebody doing the same thing because he used to just be not a bad dresser, but just dressed like a typical guy, kind of some jeans that maybe sort of didn't fit sometimes and a shirt that kind of fit and kind of didn't and sort of rumpled. But now he's become like Mr. Style, but in a cool like Rolling Stone sort of way.
Yeah, the shirt he was wearing yesterday was it was like a casual button-down shirt, but it was a really nice one. It was like blue stripes, but it was like four or five different colors of blue stripes that all worked together in this subtly harmonic way. Yes, I saw the boots.
See, I could never make those work, but he makes it work. So, so he's a good-looking man. He's a father, successful author. Apparently, at least one of his books optioned for a film and so forth. But then you get the feeling that there's just something a little demonic.
Oh, yeah. There's something just very weird and twisted about him.
There's something inside Peter Carlin that isn't quite right.
Well, the first time, I'd never actually even met him like about a year ago. And he friended me on Facebook. And the first thing he said to me on Facebook after friending me, I don't remember what it was now, but it was something just completely obscene and inappropriate.
Excellent.
And I'd never even met the man. So you know.
Well, you know, there's a certain sort of roguish charm to be had there. All right. Well, that won't make it awkward the next time he's here. So that's coming up in a couple weeks. Peter and Anna Griffin will be here. Yeah, so next week, though, Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. And then Monday, Ryan White from The Oregonian will be here as well. So there you go. We want to thank our guest, Brett Burmeister. And his website is portlandfoodcarts.com. And I'll put that link up later on today and so forth. All right,
attention,
the Rick. I'm sorry, that's totally. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk is Dawn Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Hagler. Chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. My name is Rick Emerson. It is Friday, August 20th, 2010, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, musical interlude followed by an encore of Legion of News. Coming up next, followed by an encore of The Rick Emerson Show, looping all weekend long. Thanks for listening. Be safe. Have a good weekend. See you on Monday. Bye now.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.